The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
All right, a very good morning to you. Welcome along to this morning's OTB AM. We're here with you all the way until 9:30 this morning. Myself and Owen with you. We've got a very busy show for you. We're going to talk football. Look back at last night. Look ahead to tonight in the Champions League. Jose Mourinho's back. We're also going to play you the full Joe Schmidt interview that we did yesterday. About his new book, focused mostly on the rugby as opposed to the other stuff that he's been doing everywhere else, because he did it everywhere else, the other stuff.
How was he?
Like, it's a good question, I don't know. I guess that's up for everybody else to decide.
Does he seem like a man who's at peace with the fact that he's walking away from Irish rugby?
Not at peace with the fact that it finished the way it finished, because he makes this point in the interview that all the rest of the times when he's left, he's been leaving on an upswing. You know, Bay of Plenty, he felt like that team was improving. At the Blues, they just reached the semi-final. At Claremont, they won the league. At Leinster, they won three trophies, albeit not the actual European Cup. It was the Amman Challenge Cup. And now he's leaving Ireland with, you know, the sour metallic taste of a bloodied mouth in the aftermath of a World Cup quarter-final defeat. And he said he was in with the Ireland setup last week, just for a couple of days, hanging out and doing a bit of work, I guess it's signing off stuff, and they were all talking about the Six Nations, and he was like, how do I exercise these ghosts? So,
how does he exercise those ghosts, I wonder?
With a big job in rugby somewhere.
Yeah, he stays around here till next summer, is it? And then goes elsewhere, so he's going to be around, and those ghosts are going to be right in front of him, on the same time zone, watching those games, probably itching to be up there in the stands as a head coach with some Six Nations team, and maybe that'll give him the appetite. Like, I'm not sure, from your sense, obviously he kind of distanced himself from the immediate All Blacks post that he was linked to yesterday, but I wonder how close he is to stepping back in, because perhaps there's a process to this where he needs to wean himself off for a little while, even though on the surface of it all, he just desperately wants to coach a team again.
Yeah, I think when you've had your fundamental belief system so shaken, as he must have had, because his entire best laid plans went awry in the last 12 months, that you've got to go back and look at what you did and try and change a little bit, I think. Because, like, when you think about what Stuart Lancaster's journey from that England team and their failure at home in a World Cup, like, they didn't even get out of the group, to where he is now, like, he travelled around the world and got loads of different ideas and sampled loads of different cultures and came back with, this is how I want my teams to play, this is who I want my leadership style to be, this is what I want my hierarchy and organisation to look like. So maybe Joe Schmidt does a bit of that, you know?
Where does he go, I wonder, where does he go to get that? Like, he's been in France, and he's been at home for a while, and he's been in Ireland, it's three different cultures already. Like, what is next for him? Is it different sports rather than rugby that he gets a sample from, I wonder?
I don't know. I mean, like, I don't think you have a template to go and discover new things, do you? Like, you just have to check everywhere.
Yeah, like, I just think a man of his experience, if I was Joe Schmidt's age, I would find it tough to change, that's for sure. But maybe as a coach in a sports team, that is the reason why you've got to the place where you are, is because you've always been able to change. You've always been fluid in the way you think about your sport. And maybe he's excellent at that. Maybe we haven't given him enough credit for that, that he has done that in the past.
Well, there was an interesting stuff. We talk a bit about the breakdown and the contact area in the rugby section of it. There's a bit in the book where he talks about not practicing offloads. When he was at Leinster, somebody came to him and said, I saw this great piece on Satanta the other day. So it's obviously a while back, about how your offloading game is sensational. And he was like, look, it's not offloads. We don't practice offloads. It's all about the contact area. And then he explained to your man exactly what had happened. And maybe his style changes from everything being about contact to something different. I don't know. Like, if it was an easy answer, it would be an easy answer.
Yeah, I wonder. It's just a very, very intriguing thing. It's a fascinating next step for him in his career and where he goes to, because...
Like, he could sit out and wait until the France job becomes available. Like, perfect candidate for the France job. They have a coach, obviously, but France in a home World Cup, that'd be amazing.
Do France take up Joe Schmidt in the current guise of Joe Schmidt? When they look at what Ireland have done over the past few years, stylistically, do France say,
yes,
this is the head coach we want?
Yes. Why not?
Because there were many question marks about Ireland's side of play after the most recent World Cup. Now, the flip side of that is he's been Ireland's greatest ever head coach and that he's brought them to great heights that on a consistent level that they perhaps had never seen before.
But imagine the structure that he brings to your thinking, your discipline, your style of play, and then put the talented French flair on top of that. It's a pretty compelling case, no?
Well, the discipline is obviously something that French rugby needs, and if that drip feeds down to every level of French rugby, then you're on to a huge winner there. You could do a hell of a lot worse than Joe Schmidt. There's no question about that. I just often wonder, like, what... I'd love to know what he's thinking about his own path after what happened at this year's World Cup. Is it just something that is a sour footnote at the end of his Ireland career, or is it something now that is going to haunt him a little bit as the next couple of years of his career progress?
I don't know. You should listen to this piece. It's he answers a fair few of those questions about what he thinks is going to happen. So that's coming your way after 9 o'clock this morning. Some of the rest of the stuff that we have coming up for you on the show today. Going to be talking football around about 8:05. Preview of the Champions League tonight. You can tweet us here on OTBAM using that hashtag. And then after that, we've got Mike Carlson talking to you. An amazing night last night in the NFL as the Ravens absolutely annihilated the LA Rams. And Lamar Jackson is the biggest superstar that the sport has seen since last season, obviously, when there was a new young superstar quarterback. But it turns out the future quarterbacks are already playing in the NFL at the moment. And then Ordinary Joe, the book interview with Joe Schmidt and Alan Quinlan coming your way after 9 o'clock this morning. Let's bring in the newspapers.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Yeah, so there's lots of Joe Schmidt in the newspapers today. Here's a clip from the interview, which we're going to play out a little bit later on. Going to bring you the full piece after 9 o'clock. Have a look. Your World Cup diary starts for the World Cup in 2019, but the preparations for Japan 2019 started with individual player reviews a few weeks after our exit from the 2015 Rugby World Cup.
Yeah.
Do you know
yeah.
what I mean? Like, and it seems like we've all got to this point where this is our white whale, and the white whale ends up killing Captain Ahab.
Yeah, I think the white whale was the All Blacks, though. And we died many deaths. But once we got the white whale, we got the white whale again. And I do think that, you know, those glass ceilings, that the more you focus on the glass ceiling, I think you add layers to it. And then it's harder to break. I think you make it bigger than it really necessarily has to be. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, let's not make it so big. Let's not focus so much on it that it starts to actually
inhibit us.
Become something that it's not.
And that seems to have happened here.
I feel a little bit like that. And I feel that I didn't help because I helped make it something really, really big for us.
And was that internally with the players and the coaching?
Yeah, and even internally myself, you know, it was something huge for me. And and inevitably, you know, I mentioned Daniel Goldman in the book. Your anxiety, your thoughts, your attitude, it does ripple through an environment if you're at the top of the environment. So I do think that I could have managed that better.
How? What would you do now?
I would not talk about it that far in advance. I was always thinking about things in advance anyway. I was always planning in advance. I didn't have to actually, you know, talk about it with the players. And we actually intentionally talked about periodization, about tapering, about recovery and peaking. You know, we'd never talked in those terms before. It was all about, okay, do your recovery for sure, but then let's make sure we get the upswing at the end of the week, not the end of the next year.
Yeah, that's interesting stuff. Mm.
That is interesting. That is why things went wrong in Japan, was that they focused too much on Japan. And that whole few weeks, that there wasn't enough of a focus in the thing that he believes in the most, which is the process. Is that what he's saying here? Like, is that the context of the clip?
Well, the context of the clip is that he went away from trying to win in the Six Nations to building towards and to telling the players that we're building for the World Cup in the Six Nations as opposed to trying to win. And that means that suddenly people are slightly long-term focused. Stuff gets missed in the short term. That's kind of the thrust of the argument. And look, that means that there was nothing they could have done then from the start of the World Cup. You know, it was a done deal that because they'd been thinking about it for so long that they couldn't fix it by the time they got there, which I don't think they, you know, I think that they feel like if a few things had gone their way in the World Cup, they could have ended up playing South Africa in the quarterfinals, and who knows what happens in that game. But at the same time, I totally understand the this has become the most impossible. It's like Mayo winning in All-Ireland. It becomes far more difficult for Mayo to win in All-Ireland with each passing year, irrespective of how talented they are, because psychological trauma of never getting past this thing becomes something that you talk about and obsess about. Like, all our conversations are about trying to get through quarterfinals of the World Cup.
Yeah,
we never ever talk about winning a semi-final.
That is something, in fairness, that he has spoken about before. I just wonder, like, this is clearly the difference between Joe Schmidt and the rest of us, or somebody who works in high performance and the rest of us, that when I hear that, when I hear we didn't focus enough on the Six Nations, or we didn't stick to actually focusing on what the next competition was up, and that ended up railroading our entire World Cup preparations, I kind of think that's a bit dramatic. I'm thinking there has to be some other reason here, as other than just a little drop-off in your focus. But maybe, as I said, it's the difference between us, that actually that little drop-off to someone like Joe Schmidt is this seismic thing that changes everything, that is a car crash, that does result in a terrible performance against Japan and the hammering at the hands of the All Blacks. It just seems that when I hear that, it's like, God, that is something that, if you did that, if you went back and started this year again, what would you change? And it sounds to me like we'd focus more on the Six Nations and we'd focus less on the World Cup. Would that help us beat Japan? Would that help us not get hammered by the All Blacks in a World Cup quarterfinal?
Did the players look inhibited by the occasion, and did they make mistakes doing things that they normally are capable of doing? Yeah, they did. Like, now, that doesn't really excuse what happens in the Japan game, but certainly it looked like the magnitude of the occasion in the quarterfinal was something that the players didn't deal with the way they normally would, potentially because all we ever talk about is the World Cup quarterfinal.
Well, there's no question that the magnitude of the World Cup quarterfinal was perhaps a little bit overwhelming. I think there were other factors there as well. There's a good chance any Ireland team going into that World Cup quarterfinal would have got beaten as well by that All Black team. It's just the manner of that performance.
I don't know. I mean, certainly there would have been a game.
It would have been nice to have a game. But that's the point, is like, I just can't understand why having your eye just on the World Cup means that you bomb in a World Cup quarter final. Like, I just think there has to be other factors here. And
look, I know he's not saying that's the only factor. It's like he says there's literally hundreds of factors, and you know, so you constantly try and come up with a narrative, and that's his current narrative. That might change in a while. Like, sorry, I don't want to frame this as the only thing that's they did that was wrong. There's loads of other stuff. Like, you know, we talk about selection. Do you second guess the selection? Do you put Sexton in? He's like, well, probably not now, even though I actually, you know, would have been concerned at the time about potential injury down the road. So we don't know if he's fit for that game. Does he actually injure himself and miss the quarterfinal, and everybody's going, well, why play him against Japan? We would have beat Japan anyway. You know?
In fairness, that was a conversation we were having before with the World Cup, saying which games are you not going to play Sexton for? Nobody expected him to play right the way through to New Zealand, so I think that is fair enough to think which games you weren't going to play him for, especially the way the games were staggered and there was a quick enough turnaround to the one after that. But yeah, you know, you're right. There was a multitude of factors here. It'll be interesting to see, even in a year or two, what Joe Schmidt has to say, if he does any more interviews, how his thought process about what happened at this year's World Cup has changed, or what other things are on this kind of a wedding cake of factors that allowed Ireland to fail at the World Cup.
A wedding cake of factors indeed. Irish Independent. Flynn hits back to reject claim GPA seeking pay for play. This is Paul Flynn yesterday speaking at the announcement that UPMC are going to be the GAA GPA health partner. That's a picture of Conor Hourihan celebrating after scoring for Villa last night in their 2-0 win against Newcastle. And Pep praises Arteta influence as Arsenal talk grows louder. This is amazing stuff from Pep. Of course he will be a manager sooner or later. We're going to finish the season in the future. I don't know what will happen. He was an incredible player. Normally holding midfielders have a vision on the pitch. You go to school, you read it, you understand it completely. He was so clever in that. More than that, he is an incredible human being and has a work ethic. He's already a manager. He behaves as a manager, and that's why we are so satisfied to have him here. Pep Guardiola issues best sales pitch ever for one of his staff. Like, if you're Arsenal reading this, you're going, look at him quick! Pep says he's the second coming of Pep!
Which almost allows me to believe that Pep Guardiola is actually saying, please come and get him. Look at this shiny new thing here, Arsenal.
A bit of that, isn't there?
Definitely come and wait for the net to actually fall down above your head Arsenal executives while you try and capture this guy. I don't know. It's clearly something that's developed between them over the last couple of years. A huge draw between them. Pep Guardiola has huge respect for him. Mikel Arteta has huge respect for him. It's a match made in heaven, it seems, on the sideline. And if you're Mikel Arteta, you've got to park that ambition for a while. You've got to say to yourself, I don't want to be number one for a little while longer here. This is a mission that the two of us are on here. We are best buds, hailing from Spain, going to conquer Europe on the Middle Eastern money via Manchester City here. That is the end of this relationship for them. He has to stay put.
Win a Champions League and then go.
Yeah. This thing has, the Pep Guardiola project always reaches a finality at his club. It probably won't end in them being sacked. It will end in Pep Guardiola getting sick of things and leaving Manchester City.
And who might get the gig then?
Well, there you go. And that's when Mikel Arteta leaves the side of Pep Guardiola and either steps up to be manager of Manchester City or takes on another lucrative role. His stock is sky high. This is brilliant stuff for Mikel Arteta. And it just gets better the more he kind of adds another layer of riddle to the esteem of himself.
So what if you're...
If I'm Arteta, I'm staying.
You're his agent. And you're saying, what are you saying? If you're his agent, you're getting a cut of his next deal. So you're probably saying, take the money now, buddy. But there might be no more money, though. What if it goes pear-shaped at City for Pep? He burns everybody out. Arteta becomes part of that core that burned the team out.
And also, if that does
happen...
He fails
to win a Champions League.
Well, just to entertain that notion for a moment, what then happens then is that Mikel Arteta probably gets less chances as a manager than he would do now.
Yeah.
Because Pep Guardiola might take it... Like, that's the sound of a guy who might actually take Arteta back were he to fail somewhere. But I think once you go to management level, you're not going to go back to assistant level. I think once you make that departure, you're never going to come back. But like while you're young, you kind of want to make a move like that. You want to give yourself that safety net. You want to give yourself a few more chances. Mikel Arteta, he's going to make it as a manager somewhere, it seems, the way Pep speaks about him. It just doesn't make any sense to me that he'd speak about him and be wrong.
He's like Hansel from Zoolander. He's so hot right now, he needs to take the money. Take the money.
Well, Arsenal should obviously be doing everything in their power to...
They had him. He went off and thought that the deal had been done. And then they went and got distracted. So, look, I don't know. Would you be happy with Arteta?
You would, yeah. I would be happy with Mikel Arteta.
Why? What do you know about him as a manager, though?
Pep Guardiola has given him a great reference.
Maybe he wants rid of him.
I'm a reference guy rather than a CV guy.
Right.
If I'm looking at your CV, I'll call the guy at the bottom. And if that guy's Pep Guardiola and he's saying something like that, you're hired. That's all I'm saying about that. Like, if you're comparing him to Allegri, then it's going to be...
Brendan Rodgers? Should I just go and get Brendan Rodgers? Rodgers would take the gig. It's a bigger gig, ultimately.
I don't think he would.
But no.
I don't think Brendan Rodgers would go to Arsenal at this point.
No.
This is a lovely little string to his bow at the end of the season, Brendan Rodgers. I've qualified Leicester for the Champions League. It wasn't in the fluky Claudio Ranieri way, or so he will say. This was in the methodical Brendan Rodgers way, and we managed to get back into the Champions League.
Yeah.
So I think he'll be fine waiting for that for a while. It's just if Mauricio Pochettino's in the mix. I just don't believe that Poch is going to walk back into a Premier League club willy-nilly at the moment. And going to Arsenal at that is a definition of something that Mauricio Pochettino perhaps wouldn't do. It is Arsenal on the back page of the Irish Daily Star this morning. Oba and out. Arsenal risking losing their players, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang and Alexandre Lacazette, next summer. The Gunners' crisis deepens, a star duo at risk of leaving, with a picture of Unai Emery in the middle there. Lacazette desperate to play in the Champions League, as his 30-year-old fan favourite and current captain, Aubameyang. Like, there's a situation here where the going's got tough at Arsenal, and Lacazette and Aubameyang's agents are like, we want to get out of here. And I don't have a whole pile of respect for that.
Fair enough, because you're a fan and they're supposed to stick around and try and dig the team out of it.
For a little while at least.
Oh, well, I mean, they're going to stay until the end of the season. So they'll do their best and they'll try and score as many goals as they can between now and then, because the more goals they score, the better their performance, the more likely they're going to get a transfer to a good team as opposed to a mediocre team, the more money they're going to make. So it makes sense for that. Like, maybe that's their motivation, and a good manager is going to come in and say, look, I know you're leaving at the end of the season, but you knuckle down, give me loads of goals and you'll be rich.
I just think there has to be some sort of element where Aubameyang and Lacazette are like, let's actually try and help our football team out of this, rather than just the self-praise sort of element to all of that. Like Aubameyang, I don't think his contract is up until 2021, so he might have another season after this. He's in his 30s now, getting on a little bit, perhaps only has one more move left in him. So I can see the incentive there to bang in a lot of goals and get that next move, because it will be his last move to a big club. It's just so typical here, where there's all these different factions kind of thrown in the towel a little bit. Like Lacazette's celebration at the weekend was obviously embarrassment, because Arsenal were in such a terrible position.
And 6 games in a row that they haven't won, first time in 20 years for Arsenal that that's happened.
It's a shocking record.
If they're not allowed to leave, then Sir Chip shouldn't be allowed to walk away either, should he?
Well,
he should dig in.
Sir Chip's has done his time. You know, he was there during the Arsene Wenger era. He has proven himself to be a stalwart of the club, Sir Chip's.
The Irish Examiner, their front cover is Austin Gleeson. Everything I was doing, I just felt it wasn't right. Very introspective from the Waterford Hurlers at the moment. There's been a few changes made by the new manager. A few stalwarts have been dropped from the panel, so it'll be interesting to see how they come back this year. Stephen Kenny can heal Irish football self-esteem issues is a piece from Derek Cullen, which is, I guess, one of those questions that I hope he can. I hope that he's given the opportunity to heal our self-esteem issues, because that seems to be fairly rife in Irish football. Don't have the players, can't do it. Why are we trying to pass the ball?
Yeah, does a moment like last week improve or diminish self-esteem, the performance against Denmark?
Well, we tried. Better to be trying.
I think it's a step forward. We kind of realised that actually we can look good on a football pitch.
Well, we can.
We don't need to
make a bit of an effort.
Don't need to have our self confidence through the floor to actually exist in this world.
Stick Jack Grealish in that team last week, and we qualified for the Euros.
You're lucky, yeah, as a Villa fan, you get to support Jack Grealish.
We know.
Back page of the Mirror is sign up or lose out, Ericsson. Now Jose confronts Spurs ace. So this is an interesting one, that there's been some sort of comparisons here between how Jose is speaking to Eriksen and how he's spoken to Dele Alli. Jose walks in last week and says, are you Dele Alli or are you Dele Alli's brother? And Alli came out and was like, I really appreciated that honesty. Interesting to see how Christian Eriksen might think when things start coming out publicly about whether or not Christian Eriksen wants to stay, because it was on Sky Sports a few weeks ago where Jose was basically saying that a player like Christian Eriksen needs to be sold. That Tottenham needs to get rid of him. That it's similar to the situation where Arjen Robben wanted to leave Chelsea and that they just had to cut loose, no hard feelings. And it seems that it's just kind of hurting towards an inevitability here where Jose Mourinho is going to sell Christian Eriksen. And
at Christmas.
It could be at Christmas, could be next year. So
Is he not out of contract at the end of the season?
Eriksen, well, obviously he'd go for free. Eriksen had length, so if you're talking about selling the player, it's obviously going to be January. So the line here from Matthew Dunn: Eriksen had lengthy talks with the new Spurs boss over the weekend, and Jose Mourinho is obviously out of contract at the end of the season. Eriksen, he remains a full part of the first team squad. He may find game time to come by. That is according to Jose. So it's the second time in a week that Mourinho has dealt with a player, as I mentioned, Dele Alli already. So
what did he say? Do we know what the upshot is? He may find game time hard to come by, or?
Yeah, he says, obviously I'm not going to tell you our conversation. Only me and him, we know about what we spoke about. But my decisions about starting him or not starting, selecting or not selecting, will be based on a perspective of a future. I cannot hide that. We have a present, and in football we have to focus on the present. In this case, the game against Olympiacos, but it's a club where you have to think about the future. It's quite cryptic from Jose. Is he leaving? Is he staying? Let's talk about the commitment for the club and for his colleagues and for the project. These important decisions, obviously, they have an influence on my decisions. As a head coach, it all kind of seems that he's skirting away from the issue and saying that Christian Eriksen is probably going to be out of the club eventually. But he does say that Christian is a proper guy, loves the club, loves his colleagues, amazing colleague in the dressing room, so it doesn't matter what. He's one of us until the last day, which...
Try and swap him for Gareth Bale?
Oh. Plus, how much money do you have to throw into the mix for Gareth Bale plus Christian Eriksen?
I don't know. I mean, Real Madrid.
An ability really to pay his wages.
Yeah, but I mean, they obviously have. They've got a best stadium in the world, says Jose Mourinho. So the Irish Times for you this morning: Mourinho prepares for opening night against Olympiacos, and that's himself and Harry Kane on the training ground. And then Aguero likely to miss Manchester Derby, says Pep Guardiola, ahead of the game against Shakhtar Donetsk. So obviously he limped off in the game against Chelsea, and looks like he's going to miss the game against Manchester United. And then they also have a picture of Conor Harahan celebrating with Jack Grealish following him, as Villa beat Newcastle 2-0. Harahan scored one and made the other in a 4-minute spell, both from set pieces, both absolutely deadly left foot. And Ozzie Gleeson saying that Liam Cahill coming in and getting rid of Noel Connors and Mara Shannon was a wake-up call for everybody else in that panel. And Paul Flynn dismisses talk of move towards professionalism. We haven't spoken about this, but does anybody still think that the GPA are in favour of full-blown professionalism?
Well, Paul Flynn says that they're not. You have to take him at his word that the idea of professionalism and that's what they're trying to do in an underhanded way is not the case whatsoever.
But that idea seems to have been retired around 2004, 2005. Like, it was the first 12 months, and then after that it was like, maybe professionalism isn't going to work.
What's the benefit, like, I would often be interested, what is the benefit of trying to hide a principle, Like, what is the benefit to the GPA in wanting professionalism and not telling anybody about it?
Well, one, you have a Trojan horse of like, oh, you deliver it by stealth under the cover of darkness. But, like,
I would always say with these sort of things...
Wouldn't it leak out?
Yeah, but like, I would always think that you kind of overshoot the runway when it comes to GAA policy, that you go for a complete overhaul and, say, a championship structure change, and then you might get the Super 8s. You go for complete professionalism and you get your semi-professionalism rather than the Trojan horse method. But maybe not. So I just... obviously, there's been a lot of stuff written about the GPA in recent weeks. Paul Flynn says there's been a lot of misinformation out there that they're just... that some of the stuff that's been written about them and their philosophy is actually just false. So he's been up against it, but he's come out fighting and he hasn't kind of shied away from the spotlight in recent weeks, for sure, which is kind of good to see. Back page of the London Times this morning is this story about UK athletics. It's in a crisis, says new chief is axed. So this is something that you might have seen over the past couple of days. This is regarding its incoming chief executive, Zara Hyde-Peters, who'd been due to begin her 200 grand a year role next week, until the newspaper here, The Times, revealed that her husband was allowed to continue managing teams featuring teenage athletes at their local club, despite having been banned from teaching over an inappropriate relationship with a 15-year-old girl. So UK Athletics, they initially sought to persist with Hyde-Peters' appointment before officials at UK Sport, which of course funds UK Athletics, but they stressed the seriousness of the situation. And then yesterday morning, UK Athletics announced that Hyde-Peters would not take up her new role with UK Sport, and they were saying that the chairman, Chris Clark, who's the chairman of UK Athletics, his handling of the scandal as well is come into question. So Hyde-Peters resigned last night from the board of the organising committee from the 2022 Commonwealth Games to be held in Birmingham. So it seems that it's been a situation where she's going to resign from a number of positions.
All right. The Guardian are announcing on the back page that Jonathan Liu has joined from the London Independent. So if you're a fan of Johnny Liu's writing, you should be, really, because it's brilliant. And then you're going to be reading The Guardian online as opposed to The Independent online. WADA pushes for Russia to face 4-year ban is the other story there. Russia faces an unprecedented 4-year ban from global sport after the World Anti-Doping Agency investigators found a number of positive drug tests were deleted from a database extracted from a Moscow laboratory in January. That's January this year. This is even after all the stuff that has come out post-Icarus. The Russians still at it, it turns out. Now look, before everybody rushes to say, yeah, what about the Americans and the Brits? They're also, no doubt, at various different things. However, they have yet to be discovered on the type of scale that Russia are. So this is not to suggest that this will cure all of the world's doping ills, but, you know, at the same time, you still have to deal with the ones you find. The recommendations approved by WADA's executive committee in Paris on the 9th of December would result in Russian athletes and teams barred from football's European Championships and the Tokyo Olympics next year, but also from a host of other sporting competitions. So the death penalty for Russian sports on a global scale.
I really enjoyed watching them at the World Cup last year. What a shame it would be to kick them out of the Euros.
They had to wait, obviously, until after the World Cup was held in Russia. Now it's like, I'm sure, you know.
No, because they were squeaky clean for the entire period of that hosting.
Exactly.
These things only come up when you're at the periphery of the sporting landscape, and now that the World Cup is done.
Now, obviously, they were banned from the Winter Olympics, right? Mm-hmm. Russia was banned from the Winter Olympics, but under the flag of Olympic athlete from Russia, they sent 168 athletes.
Yeah. They were quite successful, actually. They were the team I was cheering for most.
Yeah, it's like, obviously, they're going to be able to do that with the football team. Non-Russian football team, who dress in the Russian colours and speak Russian and live in Russia.
It's Guy Incognito from The Simpsons. That's what the Olympic Russia athletes from Russia was. Back page of The Sun this morning is United clean-up, owners of Hoover, a £70 million a year deal. So Manchester United closing in on world record shirt sponsorship deal with a Chinese company, which of course includes the brand Hoover. This is the higher group. So they want to replace Chevrolet's £64 million a year tie-up and remain a huge commercial draw despite the recent struggles under Solskjaer. So higher looks to be the ones that will kind of take the front of the jersey. It's not something Hoover. That Hoover, but higher is the name of the company. We don't really pay attention to shirt sponsors anymore.
Because there's so telephone book numbers, because, well, I don't know, Chevrolet didn't work. Wasn't that the first crack in the veneer at Manchester United? They pulled out. Isn't that what we have at the minute?
Yeah, well, that's why they've gone in to get Hoover, obviously, that Chevrolet aren't going to renew their sponsorship. But the thing is that they're going to up their money from Chevrolet. So perhaps they just got a better offer.
Are they really?
But it's gone from £64 million to £70 million.
Well, certainly that's what's been briefed to the Sun. Mm. That's what, you know, the business people at Manchester United are telling the journalists. That's interesting, isn't it?
The back page of the Sun as well also has History Joys, Mourinho's Champions League rally cry for Spurs against Olympiacos tonight.
The Daily Mail back page. Forgive them. Joe Schmidt hopes Paddy Jackson and Stuart Olding will be forgiven at some stage following their exodus in the wake of the Belfast rape trial last year. Being found not guilty doesn't necessarily, in some people's eyes, excuse behaviour. That's a difficult thing to overcome. You would hope that we have a system where people are punished for crime and not doing a crime, and you hope that at some stage forgiveness will be part of that. When you talk about Rory Best, I was worried because of the hashtag not my captain, the way he was isolated. What I tried to do was not allow him to be completely isolated. I could see how tough it was for him. He also says he pleaded with Simon Zebo to stay. These are bits from an interview that he's done with BBC. Where's the actual? If you were to interview Simon, he would tell you about me travelling to Munster, pleading with him to stay in the country. He was a guy we wanted to keep investing in. He was really important to us. It's not like that relationship isn't positive. I've texted him and kept in mind how he's doing at Racing. Does he fit? You don't want all people the same. We have very different personalities in the team. So there you go.
The Herald this morning leads with a story about Caoimhín Kelleher. Perhaps he's going to make a move. Liverpool willing to loan their young goalkeeper. So Liverpool prepared to allow Irish under 21 goalkeeper Caoimhín Kelleher to go out on loan in the new year, provided he is guaranteed game time. Preston are reportedly interested in the 21-year-old. He is going to be needed, though, at the moment, because there is going to be a bit of chaos with fixtures where Jurgen Klopp is over in the Middle East at the Club World Cup. Liverpool are going to be at home with their under-23s boss competing in the Carabao Cup, and Caoimhín Kelleher, you'd imagine, will be playing in those games. Also in the Herald, you've got your continuation of the top 50 dubs.
Okay, let's go. Come on, what have you got for us?
Coleman Goggins at number 40, Paul Griffin at number 39, David Byrne at 38, Owen Merchant at 37, Desi Farrell at 36.
Desi Farrell at 36?
Kevin Nolan at 35.
Is that because of the millennium?
Of the millennium, yeah.
I suppose Desi was also big in the 90s.
Yeah, dropped from the squad in 2004, playing no part as the wheels came off the wagon against Westmead.
Fair enough. The 90s were definitely his best decades.
Oh, you thought he should be higher?
In terms of, oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was a superb footballer. Kevin Nolan, 35. Owen O'Gara, 34. Ray Cosgrove is 33. Niall Scully, 32. And John Small is 31. There's your continuation of the top 50 dubs.
Right. Have you done your top 50 Kerry players of the millennium yet?
I have not, no. It's too many to choose from.
The year 2000 is such an arbitrary cut-off point, really, when you've lived through that period of time.
Yeah, I guess it is. Especially if you're looking at, with the Dublin one, it'd be tough enough to choose.
Well, Morris Fitz doesn't make your list.
He might squeeze in.
Would he?
Yeah.
Did he play in 2000 and 2001?
Yeah, obviously he wasn't as big a part as he was
when's
in 97.
When's the game in Thurles? That's
2001, yeah.
Is it? Okay, so he's still a factor.
Yeah, of course he is, and he would probably be in the top 50. It's a thing that we got into when we were doing our team of the decade a couple of weeks ago. It's like, do you appreciate the fact that greatness existed in that time period?
Even though it was past it?
Yeah, or, well, not even necessarily past it, or do you have to look at longevity throughout a decade? Like, this is something that we spoke about when it came to Gooch and Anthony Moyles' team and my team for this decade.
You stuck Gooch in it?
Because, not only because of how he reinvented himself this decade, but also because I felt that we had peak Colm Cooper in 2011. This decade, we got to see some of the best football from Colm Cooper. Now, he didn't have as many good years as he did in the last decade, but does that mean you preclude him from your consideration? Because really, as a top-class corner forward, he only had, 2-3 years max in this decade. So that's the interesting thing.
I don't really remember Kerry that much in 2011. What did they do?
They lost the All-Ireland final to Dublin. I thought Gooch was...
Sexton scores the 45 or whatever it is. Right, so that's the final. But what else did Gooch do?
Gooch was brilliant all throughout. He was fantastic against Mayo earlier on in the championship. For me, it was just... You were kind of coming away from Croke Park that summer thinking, this guy is still the best forward in the country. And Dublin people will say Bernard Brogan was that guy. And he picked up his Footballer of the Year award in 2010 and perhaps he had bigger reason to say that. But then we actually discovered that Bernard Brogan would go on to become the undisputed best forward in the country over the following couple of years. And perhaps Gooch getting overshadowed by Brogan a little bit in 2010, 2011 was actually because the guard had certainly shifted. Now... Am I actually trying to consider that Gooch's best year was 2011? Perhaps not. It's hard to actually look past 2009 and a year where Colm Cooper actually won an All-Ireland. But I just still felt that if you put him into any team in 2011, put him into that Dublin team in 2011, like he was still flying it. But also, and I think Anthony made the point as well going through his team, that 2013 was also a huge feather in his cap, the reinvention as a centre forward.
Okay, that's fair enough. The Racing Post, the final one for us from now, unless we have the Irish news, I'll tell you about that in a minute. Phoenix Racing Fund was never regulated and is now in liquidation. Amir Abdulaziz Salman's Phoenix Luxembourg Fund, lauded by its founders, the world's first regulated thoroughbred fund, has been placed into voluntary liquidation and never operated as a functioning investment fund at all. Were you at... did you see him buy a horse?
Yeah, I met Abdulaziz a few last year, I think, myself and John. We're down at the Goff's Orby sale and we met him.
Yeah. Well, that...
First time I've seen him since.
Yeah.
Got the Irish news this morning. Hart hopes Donnelly could be back for National Football League. So this is Matty Donnelly there, who is facing 6 months out with an injury. I didn't realise that.
Tore his hamstring off the bone.
Oof.
Yeah. He's saw him at the weekend. It's just at a conference I was at and wandering around on... crutches with the leg basically. It's not a cast, but like it's plastic on the thigh and plastic on the calf to make sure that the knee and the hamstring doesn't move.
That obviously happened in the club game
three or four weeks ago.
Jesus. If you tore the hamstring off the bone and they're hoping for him to be back, well, I suppose for the end of the football league, so you're talking the tail end of March.
6 months, I think.
Yeah, that is, God, that is a tough injury, especially at his stage in his career. He had a good season as well this year.
Great season, yeah. So you really wish him all the best. Hope he gets back with it. So going to bring you this. Last night, Conor Harahan, a free kick masterclass. He didn't manage to score against the Slovakian goalkeeper, Martin Dubravka. Right after this break, have a look at this.
OTB. AM. This is OTB Sports Radio. Off the ball.
Salah takes the shot. Oh, Salah with one of the goals of the season. 25 yards out.
If you throw your lot in and play senior international football with somebody, that should be the end of it.
That's brilliant. Oh, my goodness me. You will not see a better try.
Who will be All-Ireland champions? Who will see their dreams turn into reality? Whose names will be etched in history forever?
OTB Live. Never miss the action right here. Every Saturday and Sunday on Off the Ball.
OTB AM.
So now, you fast forward 4 months.
Grealish and Harahan then.
Well, yeah. We'll never see that happen in the green. But... you fast forward 4 months and it's going to be a free kick to Ireland in Slovakia, just to the edge of the penalty box, 20 yards or so from out. And
now the keeper will be alive to it.
And he'll see Conor Harahan step up.
I would prefer if Harahan had kept his powder dry.
Do you think? Because 2 minutes later, there was 2-0. Well, the Conor Harahan free kick that he sent across the goal. Yeah. And again, there was a bit of uncertainty in the area. There was more sort of defending.
The second free kick was a really good one. It's just such a difficult ball for the defence to deal with. Hard for the keeper to come out as well a little bit. Maybe in hindsight he should have. But Harahan, and it was true of the goal against Georgia as well, the tennis ball goal, he really does have an ability to get power and a flat trajectory on a ball and curl it with precision.
From the edge of the box as well. It's around the wall or whatever.
Really good.
Yeah, no, I'm all in favour of Conor Harahan perfecting the art as opposed to not keeping his powder dry.
Yeah.
Phil, good morning to you.
Good morning, yeah. How are you doing? It was an impressive set-piece display from Conor Harahan last night.
5 minutes of left-foot genius.
Yeah, and I was trying to think back to the goal that he scored against Georgia. and one of our seven goals in the qualifying campaign.
One of our best?
Probably, yeah.
The best?
The best, yeah. Given the fact that he was the equivalent of an NFL kicker being iced
yeah.
because the tennis balls came onto the pitch before he got to take that free kick. But I can't really remember many situations during the qualifying campaign where he had opportunities from set pieces apart from that Georgia game. Now, somebody could correct me on that, but when you watch him last night, you can see it's something that he practiced on. He's very consistent with it. And his all-round performance was very impressive. But people are wondering why won't he play like that for Ireland. But he doesn't have Jack Grealish creating a ton of space for him.
Could have had.
I know. We won't go there.
Stuck him on for 15 minutes.
Yeah, we won't go there. But
or was that Declan Rice?
That was Declan Rice.
We never got him in the squad, did we?
No, I don't.
He was the under-21 player of the year. We brought him over to pick up his award. Yeah, we showed him.
Kiss the crest.
This is how we'll treat you. And then, yeah.
I think he rejected us.
Shoreham Temple Bar.
Yeah, he even put up a few shamrock emojis on Patrick's Day. You know, we got our hopes up, but
yeah,
never happened. But he was brilliant last night for Villa. But because he is so good and he creates so much space, then the rest of the Villa players thrive on that. And McGinn kind of does that as well. So when he plays for Ireland, it's going to be a lot more static and he won't be as good. And people will wonder why.
Until maybe the next manager comes in and goes, look, I see what you do at Villa. You can do it for us. Come on. Yeah.
And the role he played last night as well, 4-3-3, and he played kind of behind Grealish, but Grealish, which he revealed in his interview after the game, he was basically given the license to roam. He actually said that almost like the way the Liverpool front three play, but he was quite quick to downplay, and he didn't want to compare himself to the Liverpool front three, but that was the role Dean Smith gave to Grealish, and Harrington played in behind him. And
the left of a three.
Yeah, and it suited him. And
those the three promoted managers this year have to take a lot of credit for how they've got their teams playing. Like what you're speaking about there is a manager in Dean Smith. Now, it helps us. He's brought him up from the Championship and he knows his players, these players inside out. He's clearly got the very maximum out of this bunch of players in terms of how they set up. We've spoken about Chris Wilder all season, and Farke has obviously got a lot of credit for being ambitious, perhaps naive at times, with Norwich City as well. That I don't know, there's a generation of managers that we're kind of witnessing here in the Premier League that have just done the very simple thing of getting the sum of your parts right, and these promoted teams have got a much better shot of coming up and actually kind of taking a scalp here and there.
Yeah, and Sheffield United have obviously been the most impressive of the three, but even looking at last night's game, Steve Bruce was the manager at Villa a year ago.
Yeah.
And you were watching Newcastle wondering what is the approach here. Well, it was quite clear the approach was not to concede goals.
Oh, it was terrible.
It was awful. And
I mean, this time, he was actually the manager until about a month, the start of this month last year.
Yeah. And then obviously he had a cabbage thrown at him. He's also had a job since the Newcastle job.
I'd forgotten that.
The Sheffield Wednesday.
Last night.
Yeah, that's
which is more offensive? Cabbage or pig's head?
A cabbage, I think, isn't it?
Like, the pig's head takes a lot of effort to...
Well, yeah, so in Spain, it's not a pig's head. It's a little baby pig.
Sorry.
Whereas El Clasico here in Dublin, it was actually a full giant...
Again, a lot more effort, whereas the cabbage, a lot lighter to carry.
Yeah, it's offensive.
Definitely bring it in.
Cabbage is heavy enough.
If you're stopped, you could say, I'm going to have this at half time at my sandwiches. So it's easier to get into a ground. But, yeah... Villa's home form is going to be key to them staying up. And incidentally, when Sky cover their games, they win and they don't concede goals.
I know, they're great and the atmosphere's class.
Yeah, and
if they could play late at night in front of the Sky cameras every week, it'd be great.
Yeah, and I watched Villa a few weeks ago against Man City, a game that they lost, but they caused City a few problems because they have players that can carry the ball. Grealish being one, McGinn being the other. And I just wonder what they'd be like if they had a really polished number nine that can bang in goals. Harrington scored 5 this season. He's their top scorer.
And getting back in the team, like at the start of the season, he was out. They'd bought a lot of players. He's got back in there. That's a real sign of somebody got good mental strength. The league season's been good so far. Like really good. It's very condensed. Villa are 4 points behind Sheffield United. Like the difference is Sheffield United have drawn 6 and they've drawn 2. But like...
Bizarrely... If you look at the table, we're there saying how bad Newcastle are. They're still ahead of Villa, even after losing last night.
Yeah.
What is it? 5 points separating 10 teams from 5th to 15th? That was certainly the way it looked before kickoff last night.
Well, 9 points separates Wolves in 5th from Norwich in 18th.
Right, okay, so it's
unbelievably compressed.
Yeah, and you'd imagine it's going to take shape in the next few weeks in terms of what Mourinho is going to do with Spurs, their fixtures. There's a few very winnable games, so they'll start creeping up the table. And, well, I suppose we don't really know if that's going to happen for Manchester United, because they do actually have to play Spurs in a couple of weeks. Mourinho goes back to Old Trafford.
Phil, we know you're a man who lives in a lair with 25 TV screens.
I wish I had a little sports bar going on.
What are they going to be tuned to in order tonight? Power rank tonight's Champions League.
I think I'm looking at the game. So you've got two options at 5-6. You've got Galatasaray, Club Brugge, and Lokomotiv Moscow and Leverkusen. So maybe Leverkusen are worth having a look. And then at 8 o'clock,
you got the addiction bad, buddy. Go on. What's next?
Well, 8 o'clock, then you have Real Madrid and PSG, which we already know PSG are through. Real will go through if they win, but even if Club Brugge don't win, Real, we know they're going to go through. And then you're looking at Juventus, Atletico Madrid, met in the knockout stages last season, and Juve turned that one around. Obviously, I'll keep an eye on how Spurs get on home to Olympiacos, Mourinho's first home game. I want to hear the Spurs fans sing his name, and, you know, it's almost, or will people turn up with Pochettino banners to support him? And then we'll keep an eye on City to see how they get on against Shakhtar Donetsk. And so as you're looking to see, will they pick up any more injuries? Sergio Aguero's obviously out for the Manchester derby. So Guardiola says.
Yeah, in fairness, he hasn't lied about that stuff before.
I thought he was caught. The Ederson one in particular before the Liverpool game, I thought, we've seen this before. Solskjaer did it with De Gea, but Guardiola tells the truth. But yeah, I think Real Madrid,
including the fact that Mikel Arteta is the greatest living manager of all time, according to Pep Guardiola. So I'm not sure, does he want him out or do you want him to stay?
I don't know. I think he's going to stay till the end of the season, surely.
Is he?
When it comes to showing love for another person, I think Pep Guardiola is on a level above all of us. He's a romantic man, and he's actually capable of showing affection in a public way. It is a possible thing, guys, for a human being to do. And that's how Pep Guardiola operates. All the love he's showing to Mikel Arteta is real. He would embrace him if he had to.
The Irish farmer in the Fast Show who loved your man and couldn't tell him. Is that the?
It's exactly the same storyline. It's remarkable.
Right.
Yeah, he's got options anyway. He's still only 37, Arteta.
Yeah. No rush.
He's got plenty of thinking to do.
Phil, good stuff. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
Daniel Harris is with us this morning too. Daniel, good morning to you. How are you doing?
Hey, you're right.
Yeah, which of those Champions League games would you be watching if you had to pick one and one alone?
Tonight?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I'd need to have a proper peruse of the fixture. This is simply because I'm watching Shakhtar and City for work. So I guess I should probably say that one. But I'm absolutely certain that if I actually had a free choice, it would not be that one.
Let's talk a little bit about Man United before we talk about any of the other stuff that's going on. What did you take from the 3-3 draw at the weekend? Certainly the Manchester United fans who I was following on Twitter in that first half were like, ooh, this is pretty bad. I think you made the point that Fred was holding things together for Manchester United. That's how bad things were.
Yeah, and Andreas Pereira had one of the great nightmares, which was an absolute pleasure to watch in some ways. I felt like, the first 70 minutes were terrible. On the other hand, I suppose they didn't concede as many goals as they could have done, and they have started scoring them. And that's taken a while. The question, I think, is, are they scoring goals now because those attackers are good players? And eventually they will happen upon a seam of form across a few games in a game? Or is there something in part of the process that has clicked? On Sky last night, Gary Neville was saying that what those players need is they need some experience with them. And that is a good point in that good teams that have young players in them also tend to have experience in them. I'm not certain that there's a swathe of 24 to 27-year-old elite-level players who are desperate to come and play for Manchester United. And also, it strikes me as somewhat weird that professional footballers need older players to inspire them to run around and work hard. I don't really see that those elements of football are secret and you only understand them once you've been playing for a certain number of years. And I think that is a problem with this Manchester United team. In particular, the one that I find that is a particular problem of is Anthony Martial, who, if you're playing at centre-forward, you should be knocking centre-halves around, whether physically, mentally or both. It should be a proper tussle for those centre-backs who are marking you. You should be backing into them. You should be shoving them. You should be taking them into places they don't want to go. You should be running channels. You should be running in behind. And what you see from Martial is when he gets a pass he likes the look of, he comes alive. And that's not good enough. If you watch Sergio Aguero play, for example, he will occupy two centre-backs with his movement, with darting runs. He'll come short. He'll go in the box. And if your centre-forward is not prepared to do that, then he won't show for the ball. Then it's quite hard to build attacks. And so the Fred Pereira situation, I mean, no manager in the world could make a midfield axis of those two look good or work. So it was clear when you saw United's team that they were going to have a problem in that area. But there are other areas of the team where you could expect things to be better. And when I looked at United and when I looked at the way that they played, it was that main area of centre-forward where I felt like he should be the one who's taking the pressure off this ludicrously substandard midfield.
Do you think that the forwards for Manchester United, Daniel, just actually think that Fred and Pereira are shite as well, and then they're just trying a little bit less hard because they don't have a midfield maestro behind them?
I'm fairly sure they must know that they're not good. I mean, yeah, they have to play with them. I mean, we can watch them and say these guys aren't any use. They have to actually play with them. So, yeah, I'm sure that they do know, but that's not a reason to abdicate professional responsibility on any given occasion. And so not really. And the problem is also that they can't be, those two are not going to protect your back four or your back whatever it was, your back five, your back three, you call it what you like. And that being the case, the onus is on the strikers to keep the ball down the other end of the pitch, which is why it was an error that Solskjaer made when United went ahead. As soon as United went ahead, they have a huddle with him and Phelan and Carrick and McKenna, and they take off Martial and they bring on Tuanzebe. And I understand why they did it, in that they thought that there's not long to go, so they should thicken the midfield to protect the defence. But actually, the ball just needed to be kept away from that defence, and they would have been better trying to get a fourth goal and a fifth goal. And that was really where the game was drawn in the end.
Do you think Solskjaer knows why things went right for them in the end at the weekend? Because it sometimes seems a little bit random, these upshoots in form. Because as you say, the first 70 minutes were atrocious. It just seems so... out of form with what Manchester United showed on the day to put in that performance in the last 20 minutes. I wonder if Solskjaer even knows why it changed.
I think that's unfair, actually, because I think he made good changes. He brought Lingard on at half-time and things got a bit better. And he put Lingard in, and he brought Greenwood on and put Lingard into the middle of the midfield, which gave United a ball carrier there and some pace. So I don't think that's true. And also, you can watch it and you can just look at who United's players are before you even actually look at the game. You can see that a front three of Rashford, Martial and James, and then especially when you chuck Greenwood into it as well, if you get the ball up there, they're going to cause trouble for any team because they're all good players. So I think that is why it happened. Sheffield United tired a bit as well. They do a lot of pressing. They play their game is quite physically demanding. So yeah, I wouldn't say that it was random. The problem is that, I mean, the problem is obviously, we talk about this a lot, is United's midfield. But the problem is also United's defence. And in some ways, that's more troubling because a lot of money has been spent on that defence. And they cannot be relied upon to see out a lead. We've seen United, they lost the lead against Wolves. They lost the lead against Southampton quite late on, against 10 men. They lost the lead in the last few minutes against Liverpool. They lost the lead against Arsenal. They lost the lead the other day. And really, if you spend £80 million on a centre-back, who is meant to have, he's not got any pace. The reason why he's meant to be so good is these leadership qualities and these organisational qualities, and he's meant to inspire those around him. Harry Maguire should be seeing out these games almost on his own, and that is repeatedly not happening. And so far, what we've seen from Harry Maguire is he's a good player, he's a decent player, and he's probably improved United in some ways, but he's not made the critical difference, that £80 million of centre-back that you decided to spend rather than actually have a serviceable midfield was meant to make. And actually, Chris Smalling was a serviceable centre-back. So the upgrade from Smalling to Maguire is probably not especially reflected in points. And if you'd have spent the Maguire money on the midfield and kept Smalling, I'm absolutely certain that United would have more points than what they've got. So you could say that Solskjaer's playing the long game in that he knows that the midfield needs support, needs help, but the elite level player, in his opinion, who was available to him in the summer was Maguire. And there's this notion that you build teams from the back. So that's what he did. But it's not, to me, looking like the wisest expenditure of limited funds.
Not a flop per se, but not a good decision to sign him.
Not a flop at all. Like, he's been okay. But for £80 million, and it's not about whether he's worth £80 million or not, because if you sign a player and they're success for you, then a player is worth whatever money you're lucky enough to pay for them, because most transfers don't work. But for £80 million, you're signing a Premier League player also, they should be able to come in and make a remarkable difference immediately. And when your budget is limited, there's an opportunity cost. Did you spend your money on X or did you spend it on Y? And rather than buy midfield, Solskjaer bought Maguire. And I don't feel like United would have many fewer points if they'd not have bought Maguire, kept Smalling, who's a decent Premier League level defender, and actually really good in a rear guard. So possibly more likely, in fact, to have helped United retain these leads and spent it on the midfield that would keep the ball away from the defence and actually have perhaps allowed you to score more goals in the early part of the season when United were really struggling. I would say that would have been a better expenditure of the money. And I mean, I was on here saying it at the time. So it wasn't unobvious to an amateur, because an amateur like me thought that was the case.
Harry Maguire, I'm just checking his age there, turns 27 next March. Most of the big clubs at the moment in world football have a fetish for signing very young players. And most of the rest of Manchester United's transfer dealings over the last couple of years would reflect that too. It's interesting when you're having that conversation earlier about experience. Do you expect him to go out and buy somebody like a Jean Moutinho type figure, and you see the role that he performs for Wolves, somebody like him, obviously not him, but somebody like him for the midfield role as a stopgap while some of these young players are developing and evolving?
Probably not, no. I mean, you never know exactly what United will do in the transfer market. I mean, we watch it, we know, everyone knows that they need players, but then at the same time, Solskjaer's already sort of got his excuses in. Last week, talking about how it's difficult to sign players in January, he might not be able to get anyone. Clubs don't want to sell their players. So they have already started to suggest that that won't happen. And the player that they're meant to be interested in, that the most people who purport to know the most think that they're interested in, is Declan Rice, who to me looks like a centre-back playing in midfield, not like someone who's going to be able to conduct games for you. I think the other thing is that United know that they've got some good midfield players coming through, at least one or two of whom they expect to make it. There's a kid signed from Monaco called Hannibal Medbury, who they think will be in the first team in a couple of years minimum. There's also Dylan Levitt, who's already in the Wales squad, and Jimmy Garner. And they think that there's a good chance that at least one, maybe two or three of those guys will make it. So in some ways, signing someone who's 27, 28 makes sense, because then you're not essentially putting them in front of these players, because by the time those players are ready, your more experienced player is finished. But I don't think that's what will happen, but it's impossible to predict what United will do. I think the chances are is they will try and buy another young player, another young British player probably, and they may or may not be good.
If you had to turn back the clocks and you were involved in the Manchester United hierarchy, Daniel, who would that midfield signing have been if your transfer kitty was £80 million? Like, you look at the midfield signings that have been made in the off-season before now, it would have been Tanguy and Ndombele, it would have been Rodri, although that was kind of squared off a good while beforehand by Manchester City. Who would that person have been that would have made the material difference, because they have spent money in midfield and they have failed?
It's hard to know necessarily who you can get. I mean, United, no secret, wanted Sean Longstaff, who is someone I really like the look of, and I would be prepared to back Michael Carrick's judgment in that regard, because he knows the player, he knows the person as well. His brother knows him really well, and Carrick played in that position. So if they had wanted to buy Longstaff, it would have been very easy to say that seems like a good buy, and someone I also really like what I've seen. I mean, the dream signing for me would have been Saul, but why would he leave Atletico Madrid? Similarly, I think Thomas Partey is a good player. He was someone else I would have also looked at. So that's three players who are off the top of my head, I think, might have made United better. There's a young player, Camavinga, in France, who is meant to be exceptional, but he is young, and I'm not going to pretend I watch a lot of Rennes, because I don't. There are people on the internet that will tell you that they do, and also tell you that he is also very good, but I don't know. Wilfred Ndidi, if I was going to Leicester, I would say Wilfred Ndidi and Harry Maguire were definitely, and sorry, Wilfred Ndidi and Youri Tielemans were two players I would have signed well before I signed Harry Maguire. So and Tielemans cost Leicester, relatively speaking, bugger all. So I don't buy the notion that there aren't players available who United to whom United's exchequer could stretch. So you never know, as I said, with the transfer. 50% hit rate on transfers for any manager is pretty good. You don't know which ones are going to work, but there are midfield players who would make United better. And in a sense, you're not just looking for midfield players who make United better, because United are so weak in that area that there are loads of players who aren't really good enough for where United want to get to who would make United better. What you're looking for is the players that are going to take United back to where United were. And Wilfred Ndidi looks like a player who could do that. And he's looked for 2 years like he was going to develop into that kind of player. But yeah, the dream would have been subtle, but I can't imagine he would fancy leaving Atletico to go and play for United particularly.
Last question for you. Has Jose Mourinho already fixed Spurs? Dele Alli saying that this guy's a genius. He's talking to me like a human being. He locked Christian Eriksen away for a couple of hours last night and said, time to shit or get off the pot. So, you know, all of the issues that Spurs had wrapped up in 24 hours.
It's amazing. I mean, Mourinho's a brilliant manager. Anyone who thinks otherwise doesn't understand football. The question is whether Mourinho, the person, has allowed himself to become overtaken by his bad elements that will stop him being the all-time great manager that he already is. Things with Mourinho tend to start okay, and then they tend to disintegrate. And that has happened everywhere he's been. But if Spurs can get 2 years of success out of him, then that will be worth it for them. I doubt that he's solved the problems with Spurs, but I'm sure that he's had a revitalising effect on players who felt that they'd gone stale under Pochettino. And as we said the other day, like my complaint with Levy and Pochettino wasn't that Levy fired Pochettino, it was that he allowed him to get to this point. And the fact that it got to the point where Pochettino had to be fired was bad form on Levy's part, because the only thing he really had to do was keep Pochettino happy. But the reality is that if the players had had enough of Pochettino, didn't want to play for him, then the manager in that circumstance has to go. So getting rid of Pochettino is a no-brainer, and anyone that comes in, you would expect to see some kind of bounce, never mind whether it's someone who the players will be fascinated to see who he is and how he relates to them. So Mourinho has also, he's got this great job now that he probably didn't think he was going to get so quickly. So he is probably quite excited about life, and he's got much better players than he had at United. So I'm sure for now he's excited. The question is, for how long that level of excitement and charisma and love and joy can be maintained before the griping and the grudges and the bitching and the whining and the negativity take over. And if he can banish that part of himself, because again, like he did at United, he's got a job that perhaps he didn't think would come up for him, then he's a brilliant manager. And if not, then he's a mood hoover.
I think an underrated part of this story is that he's going to be living at home instead of living in a suite in the Lowry. I think it's a big deal to be happy in your personal life.
It's absolutely a big deal to be happy in your personal life. And whether or not he's happy in his personal life, I don't know. But he still acted like a bitch at Chelsea the second time around he was at home. So I wouldn't necessarily say that's the answer. But as a general point, I absolutely agree. We'd all like to be happy in our personal life. I'm saying this in a really loud voice in the hope that my wife will hear.
We'll leave it there. Daniel, good stuff. Enjoy tonight's games. Thanks a million.
See you. Bye.
Daniel Harris there talking to us about the situation. I mean, he did act like a bitch in Chelsea. It was the immediate return after the summer when he had the fight with the doctor that caused the conflagration that blew everything up.
And that summer tour as well. He wasn't happy with the long-haul flights to the United States, wasn't it?
What was the...
Like, every team has to do it, and he wasn't willing to go along with it.
Did we ever find out really what was the cause of all that?
Something went wrong in that summer.
Did he want out of... He wanted to get the Man United job.
Potentially.
Should have just bought a gaff in Manchester.
That full story has kind of been well explored, but you'd imagine there's a little bit more once the dust has settled and Jose kind of tells a story about that.
It'll happen again.
Yeah,
it's going to be an interesting 18 months/3 seasons. Here's Gary Breen talking about Arsenal's problems and their cotton wool culture.
It's literally gone from one extreme to the other, in that Wenger would rarely change it. Wouldn't do it. Maybe he did with that back five towards the end of his reign to try and get a bit of solidity back there. But he plays a back five for the first time of the season against Leicester, and they just got absolutely ripped to pieces. To the extent where you have Lacazette and Aubameyang, two really good centre forwards. Of course, they're at this level. They had to track Leicester's overlapping fullbacks. They were more like left backs and right backs themselves. And this is the frustration. And ultimately, what this does is it just gives those players, those weak players, a crutch to say, listen, this manager, we don't know what he's doing. And you'll hear that. You'll hear those soundbites coming out of that dressing room now. And that's the frustration, because I think he's a very hardworking manager. I think he's a good manager. But ultimately, the reason why he's failing is that he did not rid that team of that Wenger cotton wool culture, where they're just so weak mentally. They're gifted, technically gifted players. Yes, they are. Of course they are. But they're woefully below the standard associated with Arsenal.
Right. Woefully below the standards. But that's the new standard. That's who Arsenal are. That's your identity, buddy. Anyway, let's move on. This slot is titled Owen's US Sports Awards.
Well, it is time for our US Sports Awards. Probably the first of one US Sports Awards, because, of course, everybody in the United States is a winner. So we're going to start this week. We're going to hand out around five awards. The first award this week is for journalism, excellence in journalism. And the winner is NBC Sports, because it is, of course, a huge week in the United States of America. This Thursday, Ger, it is Thanksgiving. Here is how NBC Sports previewed their festive football. Killer line at the end from Al Michaels. Going to be a rough week for that crew, says Al Michaels. He's not wrong. Good this job, is not the first time, of course. not the first time that NBC have done something like this. Have a look at this one from 2014.
Say goodnight, guys.
Right.
Excellence in journalism from NBC Sports. Incredible revelations, really, that the turkey you eat this Thanksgiving is indeed going to be dead.
People don't like to see live turkeys. That's not how turkeys look in people's heads. Turkeys are like cooked.
This is the weirdest tradition in American sports, this NBC obsession they have with showing a slaughterhouse 4 days before Thanksgiving. It's messed up. It's completely absurd. But still, excellent journalism. So well done to everybody at NBC for that. That is why they're the recipients of the
part of the anti-meat vegan movement.
NFL broadcasters, really?
Do I really want to eat those? Look at those. They look nice. Like those nice sentient beings.
Well, okay, here's the thing for you. It probably is a little bit grim for a Tuesday morning, but I've got a good news turkey story for you. Here's a photo of the turkeys called Bread and Butter in a luxurious suite this week before Donald Trump pardons them today from being killed and consumed. It's the best tradition, I think, in the United States. They're staying at the Willard Hotel before Trump gives them their pardon. Right, next award, Pundit of the Week. And let me ask you this question. How do you turn this lovable rogue Rob Gronkowski into a psychopathic Russian Bond villain? That's right. You put him into a turtleneck jumper. Is it Steve Jobs? Is it your man with the big head from Despicable Me? Is it the local 30-something-year-old lad in your area who got carried away with his one-for-all voucher at Christmas? Forget anything he actually said. Pundit of the Week, Rob Gronkowski, turtleneck. Can he pull it off?
No.
Nobody can pull off a turtleneck. It is the award for Fan Moment of the Week next, so you covered it here on OTB AM last week. It is the story of the fight between Mason Rudolph of the Steelers and Miles Garrett of the Browns last week. For anybody who missed this, Garrett ripped off Rudolph's helmet and then proceeded to bash him over the head with the helmet. So Garrett got an indefinite suspension. It was always going to be interesting to see how the Browns fans reacted at the weekend. Would they protest? Would they wear T-shirts in his honour? Instead, they just decided to play some piñata. Oh, so we've got a pinata here of Mason Rudolph of the Steelers hanging by a stick while a little girl is playing the role of Miles Garrett with a helmet in her head trying to whack the pinata. It is fantastic.
Blindfolded.
Blindfolded, I should say. You can't really play a pinata any other way. It is a fan moment of the week. So Cleveland Browns, congratulations to you. Next award.
Mason Rudolph's Trump supporter, by the way, just to add a little bit of context.
Yes, that doesn't surprise me one bit. Looks like a Trump supporter. Gobshite of the Week is next up. And let me ask you another question. So if you were a quarterback about to get your first ever NFL win as a starter and the game is still on, where should you not be?
Well,
this is where you should not be. This is where you should not be. Have a look at this one as well. Taking selfies on the sideline is probably where you should not be. That is Dwayne Haskins of the Washington Redskins, who is this week's gobshite of the week. While that photo is being taken, veteran quarterback Case Keenum is out there actually playing the last play of the game. So
kneeling down.
You're going to congratulate.
This happens all the time.
And to be fair, the tickets for that game were like going for $3 or something like
right,
that.
Bad, yeah.
So they're very, very bad. Finally, today we've got Apology of the Week. And it's not from the NFL, it's actually from the NBA. This is one of my favourite stories of the year because it comes from a media background. Anybody who's listens to podcasts or produces podcasts will get a great kick out of this. So Josh Hart has had to apologise to his former Los Angeles Lakers teammates because his podcast producer is also a gobshite. So Hart, he had Lonzo Ball on his podcast back in September, and you're going to hear Lonzo Ball's voice in this in just a moment, and he's talking about his experience in Lithuania, and then you're going to hear Josh Hart compared to Los Angeles, and then you're going to hear their dumbass producer.
It's solid. You're going to have a good time. Lithuania was very depressing. I went there too to go visit him. I wouldn't do it again.
They got some shooters out there though.
Man, it's like, you been there?
No,
you been there?
I'm not going there.
No. It's like hella gloomy. Like nobody smiles. It's like everybody just hates that they're there. I'm like, damn. Yeah, no, I had to get out of there, bro.
Sounds like LA.
Nah, it's definitely not LA.
No, I'm not talking about the city.
Oh. I don't know what he's talking
about. What are you talking about, bro?
I don't know what he's talking about. Next question.
We're gonna edit this part out, so you might as well just tell us.
I was gonna say the Lakers organization.
Oh shit. Miles cut. Miles cut.
Yeah, so thanks very much to your producer for saying you're going to cut out that piece of audio of you slating your former teammates and then proceeding to include that piece of audio in the podcast. So he's had to come out this week and say it was just being sarcastic. No hard feelings, everybody. And sorry to the Los Angeles Lakers, but he's based in New Orleans now, so he's well away from it. So that is your apology of the week. And there are your five U.S. Sports Awards.
Very
Everybody's
good.
A winner this week.
Yeah, it turns
Happy
out.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Except that guy.
And the turkeys, they're all dead, probably now.
Yeah. All right, here's Kevin Doyle from Friday Night Racing. We really interesting chat with the former Irish international last week. It's one that's worth digging out. It's available on YouTube, our website, and as a podcast on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your pods.
When you were playing, you obviously always had this in the back of your head that this was going to be something that you were going to spend a bit of your time post-retirement in. Was there other stuff that you had your eye on getting involved in while you were still playing?
Yeah, listen, you always try the coaching side. I did a bit of coaching with Ireland under-17s last year. It was fine. I enjoyed it. And, you know, I do the punditry side of it with RTE and a few different things. But this is, I suppose, what, you know, talking to you about this gives me a lot, probably more enjoyment than talking about...
Let's talk about the Ireland international team, though.
Yeah. So, you know, that's... Well, work side of it, and this is enjoyable, and so this
you
is.
Can't
really
show them
lucky.
Up, Ger. You cannot show them up.
Yeah, so I've been lucky since I came home. You know, retiring from football is a big thing in your life. Retiring from a sports person, retiring, I suppose. You see all the talk about depression and players really struggling, and I've been so lucky to come home, and you know, I'm not in England in a house sitting there twiddling my thumbs, wondering what I'm going to do with my life now. I'm finished soccer, I've come home, and I'm out, you know, mucking out stables, or out this morning walking horse in the rain, or whatever, and it just. I suppose it's made my transition a lot easier from full-time training.
Yeah, that's great stuff. Really good stuff on the Ireland football team as well. John Duggan's here with the roundup of what's going on. John, how are you?
Ger and Owen, yeah, good morning. And Tottenham Hotspur manager Jose Mourinho says Spurs need to have the right attitude if they're to contend for the Champions League this season. Spurs welcoming Olympiacos to the new Wild Hart Lane tonight. In the knowledge, a win will clinch their spot in the last 16. And ahead of the match, Mourinho believed to have held talks twice in the last week with the want-away midfielder Christian Eriksen. And Mourinho says his players need to take a leaf out of Liverpool's book.
When you are almost... landing on the moon and you don't do it. I believe that the frustration is very, very high, but at the same time you look to a team like Liverpool, and they also had the frustration of not winning a final, and then the next season they reach the final for the second time and they win the competition. So I think it depends a lot on the people's mentality.
That Group B game kicks off at 8 o'clock. In the other match in that group, Bayern Munich are away to Red Star Belgrade. Manchester City just require a point at home to Shakhtar Donetsk in Group C to reach the knockout stage. Sergio Aguero out now of that game with a thigh injury. Also an 8 o'clock start at the Etihad Stadium. In the pick of tonight's other Champions League matches, Real Madrid hosting PSG and Juventus up against Atletico Madrid. Corkman Conor Hourihan scored one goal and set up another as Aston Villa beat Newcastle 2-0 in the Premier League last night, the result sending Villa to 15th in the table. And Cork native Hourihan told Aston Villa TV he was delighted to get on the score sheet.
Yeah, not too bad. I always like to chip in with goals and assists. Like you said, you know, I'm all about numbers, I suppose.
you know, over the years. So I'm delighted to keep the goals coming.
Joe Schmidt has done an interview with BBC Radio Ulster. He said it was impossible to predict if Paddy Jackson and Stuart Holden will be welcomed back into Irish rugby. The pair were acquitted of all charges in the Belfast rape trial last year, but were sacked by Ulster and the IRFU after the emergence of WhatsApp messages. Schmidt said, being found not guilty doesn't necessarily, in some people's eyes, excuse behaviour. That's a difficult thing to overcome. You would hope that people, we have a system where people are punished for crime and not doing a crime, and you would hope at some stage forgiveness would be a part of that. Russia's staging of matches at Euro 2020 could be in doubt following a recommendation by a World Anti-Doping Agency committee that the country be banned from sport for 4 years. The Russian Anti-Doping Agency has been deemed non-compliant over inconsistencies in their data, putting Russia under threat of having competitors as well at next year's Tokyo Olympics. A final vote will be held by WADA, their executive committee, on December 9th. Will it be fudge or will it be ban? And a seven-race national hunt card at Punchestown today. Get the hot whiskies out in your hip flask for the first off at 12:40.
Good stuff, John. Thanks very much for that. Now, as Owen pointed out, it's Thanksgiving week and all those turkeys are going to be killed. It's the business end, or the beginning of the business end of the NFL season. I'm delighted to say Mike Carlson is back with us. Mike, good morning to you. How you doing?
Good morning. Yeah, speaking of Thanksgiving turkeys, here I am. Yeah, my favorite time of the year, actually, my favorite holiday, and it's a shame really that I won't be in the States for that. But that's the way it bounces. And of course, there's three NFL games on Thanksgiving, which to me is kind of turkey overkill. But one of them's traditional, one of them's half traditional, and one of them is just the gravy on the stuffing.
Yeah, it's a long day of people getting drunk and eating lots of food and watching football. I want to talk to you about what bandwagons we should be getting on. It's that time of the year where we're trying to encourage people to get on board. The easiest one, surely, right now is the Lamar Jackson bandwagon, because he looks like one of the greatest athletes that the world has ever seen. Certainly, he's playing at a level that no one has ever seen before.
Yeah, and it's a perfect mix. And when I watched Lamar Jackson in college at Louisville, you could see that he had an awful lot of talent. You simply wondered about the competition he was facing. And when he played the bigger college teams, he always did relatively well. He had great running skill, but also good passing skills and techniques. Reminded me a little bit passing of Teddy Bridgewater, who got labeled as a run first quarterback unjustly, and was doing pretty well before he had that terrible injury in Minneapolis. But Lamar has had the benefit of coming into a team that, once they realized that they wanted to move away from Joe Flacco and him, was able to put together an offense that takes advantage of his skills, which is really what any rookie quarterback in particular wants. But he's playing on a good team, unlike most rookie quarterbacks, because he was drafted at the end of the first round. So he gets drafted by one of the better teams in the league, although the Ravens traded back into the round to get him. And if you think about when Colin Kaepernick had his two really good years in San Francisco, it was when John Harbaugh was coaching and Greg Roman was the offensive coordinator, and they ran a lot of designed run plays for the quarterback. And Greg Roman is back as the offensive coordinator with Jim Harbaugh, John's brother, in Baltimore. And they're running an offense that's much the same as that, has a lot of the same concepts in it. But it's also helped by the fact that they have an enormous and effective offensive line. He's got good receivers to throw to, including three tight ends, so they can run in two tight end sets. And he's got a couple of really good running backs. Picking up Mark Ingram from the Saints turns out to have been a master move, because Ingram was always sharing time with the Saints. Here he can be a feature back, but rested for Gus Edwards, who's also really good. And it's very, very hard to stop, as we saw last night against the Rams, as we saw when they beat the Patriots, who are an exceptionally good defense. It's a very, very hard offense to stop.
I was just about to ask, Mike, has there been any template whatsoever that comes anywhere close to stopping this guy? Because so I was just looking at a piece yesterday on ESPN, and it's like no matter what sort of coverage you throw at the guy, he will always find a way out of it, whether it's through his athleticism or through his arm.
Yeah, I would say that the Patriots did a fair job of it. that the concepts were pretty good. But as you just said, he can defeat those concepts because he's just so agile, and he has such a good sense of peripheral vision, of short area quickness, of being able to escape the rush. So if you do try to stack the line against the run, if you do try to defend back against the pass, he can trip you up either way. It's going to be a very, very difficult task. And, you know, last night, Wade Phillips is no slouch as a defensive coordinator. And early on, it seemed, you know, once or twice he might have, you could see how they were trying to force Lamar Jackson to stay in the pocket, to just squeeze him in the pocket. They couldn't do it. He was just too escapable. And the other half of the Ravens thing now is, since picking up Marcus Peters from the Rams to play cornerback and then getting Jimmy Smith back from injury to play the other corner, they've become a really good defensive team, which is what you expect from the Ravens normally. But because those two guys are both in effect lockdown corners, it makes their front seven much more effective. And with Earl Thomas, the former Seattle safety, sitting behind Marcus Peters, he's free to gamble, which has always been the downside of his game. He's willing to gamble and sometimes loses. Receivers make big plays against him. I thought the really funny thing at the end of that game was Marcus Peters jawing off with Jalen Ramsey, who for some reason seemed to come over after the game, just have words with him. And a lip reader could quite easily say what the first two words from Marcus Peters were to Jalen Ramsey.
Yeah, because essentially the Rams gave up Marcus Peters for a fifth round pick and then traded two first round picks for Jalen Ramsey. So they're massively out in that deal. And it looks like their season might be over after this. So there was a beatdown last night. If anybody's unaware, the Ravens beat the Rams 45-6. This is on the back of beating down the Patriots just recently, beating down the Texans last week, and also beating the Seahawks. So if there is a bandwagon, if anybody out there wants to get interested, go and support the Ravens for the rest of the season because they're absolutely amazing.
Yeah, it's funny. Peter King, the former Sports Illustrated writer, tweeted yesterday before the game that recency bias is a great thing, and people should be smart and recognize recency bias, and the 49ers are going to go all the way to the Super Bowl. And my immediate reaction was to tweet him back and say, well, when the 49ers lose to the Ravens this week, are you going to say recency bias is completely bogus and everybody's got to jump off recency bias? But I think we're looking possibly at a Super Bowl preview there when the Niners go to Baltimore this week.
Well, I really hope so, because the Niners are the other bandwagon that people should be getting on board. Their defense is playing at not quite a historic level, but not far off it.
Yeah, and they're, in fact, it's kind of the flip of the Ravens situation, because their defense has been good all year, and it's based up front. And they've got Akello Witherspoon back from injury, that one of their corners, Richard Sherman, the other former Seahawk, is on the other side. And they've become really stifling. And their pass rush against the Eagles against the Seahawks was really spectacular. There was one play where Nick Bosa launched himself over a blocker and onto Russell Wilson, which is a move that you don't see very often. But the thing with them offensively is like the Ravens picking up Marcus Peters, when they got Emmanuel Sanders as a receiver, it completes their offense. And when you think of the Niners offense, you should think about the Atlanta team that went to the Super Bowl and lost to the Patriots because Kyle Shanahan was their coordinator. They want to attack you on levels, and so they need to have good players at each level. They've got backs who can catch out of the backfield, including Tevin Coleman, who was in Atlanta with Shanahan. They have George Kittle, who's one of the two best tight ends now in the NFL and can go deep downfield, can catch the balls. And now with Sanders, it gives him that flexibility of another level. He can play the slot and come across. He can go deep from the outside. So really, to me, the question with them is, will their offensive line hold up? They won most of those games the first half of the season without both their starting tackles. And it's taken the two, Joe Staley, Matt McGinchy, it's taken them time to reacclimate to the game. They played much better this week than they had the week before. And can Jimmy G rise to the occasion, you know, and play at the top level against the top teams? And, you know, right now I think the answer to that is probably, yeah, he can.
So you're saying that there's question marks over the offensive line, and by extension of that, Jimmy Garoppolo's performances so far this season – I kind of deserve more praise because he doesn't have the level of protection that other quarterbacks have.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think when he's got all his weapons, and if McGlinchey and Staley can play well and protect him, I think they're going to be dangerous. You think of how well their offense played at times last year with Nick Mullins at quarterback, you know, who nobody even considered. And they should be really good. I wouldn't anoint them as the NFC champions quite yet, because the NFC is a lot more competitive than the AFC at the top. You know, we're really talking about in the AFC, New England and Kansas City is the only real challengers to Baltimore, and Baltimore holds the tiebreaker over New England. They've already beaten them. Kansas City still has problems injury-wise and defense-wise, and New England is offensively a mess, but they managed to beat Dallas in a nor'easter in Boston, 13-9, which isn't like the Ravens steamrolling over people, but they seem to find ways to get teams beat. But in the NFC, you've got, you know, maybe five legitimate contenders to go through the playoffs there.
Is there a bandwagon building about the end being imminent for Tom Brady? I mean, I know his personal trainer is saying he's got to play until he's 46 or 47, but he hasn't looked the same this year.
No, that's true. But you have to try to dissect how much of it is Brady and how much of it is the fact that he doesn't have any receiving targets to speak of, that his offensive line is a mess. It's a little bit better with Isaiah Wynn finally back, who's had, I think, before this in 2 years, one start for the Patriots since they drafted him in the first round. And because of the offensive line, primarily, they can't get a running game going, which was kind of like their what they were going to build to this year. So he does not look good. He misses some easy throws. He throws the ball away a lot, not to take sacks because he's not very mobile, but, and his receivers are not giving him a lot of help. To be honest, on Sunday night, I thought that Julian Edelman looked older than Brady. And he still made a couple of big catches in the fourth quarter. But, you know, the Patriots defense will get them a ways in games, but they really do have to start generating more offense. And I don't honestly see how they do it with the personnel that they have offensively. So I would suspect in Tom Brady's mind, he wants to come back with a more potent offense and prove he's not washed up, even if it's only for one more year. But he has taken a bit of a beating this season, and it shows kind of in the way he plays.
Who do you think will come out of the NFC at this point?
Well, I mean, the 49ers are obviously they're in the front runner's position with one loss. Although, like I say, I think going to Baltimore this week, I would probably pick the Ravens in that game. I think the Saints are a balanced team, but they always seem to find ways not to get the top help by the referees and by their own. It's as if watching the Saints last Sunday, it's as if they think because of that bad decision last year in the playoffs, which prompted the pass interference review and all that, that they've got to get out of jail card free for penalties this year because they really are committing a lot. And the referees still are not giving them any breaks in that way. I think the Saints are probably their best challengers because not least because I think the Panthers are falling off in their own division. But you also have to look, you still have to look at Green Bay simply because Aaron Rodgers is there. You have to look at the Seahawks because they hang in games and Russell Wilson finds ways to help them win. And, to me, Dallas and Philadelphia are toast right now. So you can kind of forget about the East. And Minnesota's still a kind of wild card for a wild card, because what they can do is play defense if they have a lead. And they've actually been getting some leads with Kirk Cousins without having Adam Thielen as a receiver. So, you know, Stephon Diggs is their only top flight wide receiver. And they've been using Kyle Rudolph, the tight end, a lot more. But they want to run the ball, control the ball, get a lead, and then blitz you like crazy. And so it's a very simple formula, and everybody knows that's what they want to do, but they do it well. So, you know, there'll be a team that I think they go to Seattle this week, and that'll be a really interesting game to watch. for its ramifications on the playoffs, but also just the contrast in styles between the two teams.
Yeah, Mike, great stuff. Great to have you with us this week. Thanks a million and happy Thanksgiving.
Always good. You too. And yeah, three games. See how many of those I watch.
Right, we'll talk to you again soon. That's Mike Carson giving us some bandwagons to get on board this week. Right, up next is our full uncut hour-long conversation with Joe Schmidt. We spoke about his book, Ordinary Joe. We got into real detail about where he thinks Ireland's World Cup campaign went off course. We're going to be back tomorrow, obviously, at 7:30. The show is on air and online, 7 p.m. tonight. You can podcast this show or you can watch it back on YouTube. But after this break is the now former Irish head coach, Joe Schmidt.
OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station. OTB Sports Radio.
We've got a panel who know a thing or two about being trailblazers.
Paul Rouse. Sport was already kind of impeded upon.
Sinead Cassan.
Doesn't innate interest in it anyway.
Dermot Ling. It didn't blow me away with him.
Jason Sherlock and Kieran Donaghy with us.
Basketball would have been my main game.
Retro panel for you now.
This is OTB Sports Radio. The Retro Panel. Wednesdays and Thursdays from 4. OTB AM.
All right, you're very welcome along. Ordinary Joe by Joe Schmidt is available now and published by Penguin Ireland. Joe's going to be in conversation with our own Joe Malloy in Dublin, Limerick and Belfast. Tickets for the events are available here at penguin.co.uk/events. And I'm delighted to say Joe Schmidt is with us. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks to you.
Really? Is this the worst part of this? Yeah. Over for you now?
It's just not something that I'd normally be doing. I try to keep a relatively low profile outside of our match week, so it's a little bit uncomfortable at times.
So why did you do it?
Because the whole project started off as a bit of a project with my mum, sort of doing the early chapters, and then after doing the coaching for 25 years, I just felt like that there were a number of experiences and learnings that I'd had and reflections that I thought I'd put them down. And then I still wasn't quite sure that I'd actually produce something with it, but I had it and I'd done the work for it, and I thought, you know, I may as well put it together.
There's a John Wooden quote in the middle that struck me as being kind of central to the whole thing. Success is peace of mind, which is a direct result of self-satisfaction and knowing you did your best to become the best you're capable of becoming. Do you have peace of mind?
Sometimes, yeah. You're always learning, and so you always feel like you can do things better. And you know, I guess that's a part of the human nature. That connects. I think I mentioned that it connects with Maslow's self-actualization, that you actually want to try to become that best version of yourself. And I think it's one of the things that I try to challenge the players around as well, so that they can not just be the best player they are, but the best person. Because I think when you've got a really good group of people, and I do feel privileged to have played, have spent time with a playing group that have been such a good group of people.
That hierarchy of needs is something that Jim Gavin talks about as well, and I wonder if it's almost a bit of a shield, because all sporting careers end in failure in some level, and that you play matches and the results dictate a lot of how you're going to feel about it, even though you're trying to remove that. Constantly you're saying, there's a bit where you talk about, somebody asked you about the England game that you'd lost, and you were like, actually, that was our best performance. You know, you must have been frustrated with that. So that whole kind of notion of results not dictating how you feel, it's also seems like it's impossible for you at the same time.
Yeah, it is. I guess it's a paradox. You try to minimise that impact by prioritising the people and the performance and the process, not the result, because the result have... There's so many variables in the result that you can't control, that you can't always get the right result. And sometimes some of the variables are under your control and you didn't play well enough, and there's examples of us not having done that. You try to then learn from those and learn from the wins as well, as I say and in the book. But those tend to scar a little bit. And if you ask me about what I remember, I do remember a lot of the losses. All of the losses probably, but some of the good days I've actually disciplined myself to remember. And I think I was asked if I had one piece of advice for Andy Farrell taking over, my advice would be just enjoy those really good days, because they come and go.
How did the scars affect you
You mentioned the scars of losses, because in my time knowing you, obviously you never coached me, you never had, I never had the privilege of you coaching me, and I often say this, that I probably wouldn't last 5 minutes in your regime because of the detail and stuff, but you sound like, it seems like that you're a planner and you're a thinker and you're always looking ahead. So when you went into coaching first, had you any plan or structure to deal with losses, or, you know, because a lot of people in sport are not successful, or is it just, did you just go with the flow through enjoyment of coaching?
Yeah, part of it was I was kind of bossed into it. I started teaching and the boss said, you're going to coach rugby. I volunteered to coach basketball, and I went into it purely because, you know, it was part of the school that you had to do it. And then also, the more I got into it, and I actually enjoyed it, because it is a form of teaching in a lot of ways, the kind of, I got a real, sort of a buzz from seeing kids improve. And I started off coaching 13, you know, under 14, so 13-year-olds, and also the enjoyment they got out of it. And you know,
did you give them a rollicking now if they didn't pull their socks and pull their weight properly, even back then?
Not really, because you were trying to be as competitive as you could, and you're talking about young hearts and minds. So it's they haven't had the experiences that harden people against that or prepare people for that so much. We'd still. I might give them a rollicking if they weren't respectful of the opposition, or they, you know, I talk about one time I was horrified where they did this grenade celebration where after scoring a try, Glenn Horton, the players kind of assembled a little way away from him. He pretended to pop the pin out of the ball grenade and lobbed it into the other players, and they all fell about.
Sounds great.
Yeah,
sounds cool.
Well, they copied it off rugby league, I would be a bit of a traditionalist as far as the values of the game are concerned, and showing respect. And I did actually think there was going to be a mass brawl. The crowd was really thick. It was a derby.
Didn't like it.
No. Well, one particular parent of the opposition didn't like it. He came on the field, and thankfully the referee defused it. And after the game, I was. Our captain was very apologetic about having, you know, maybe got carried away. I think it was a bonus point try, and the boys were pretty excited about
it. I wouldn't like to have been one of those boys facing. You know, the perception is that the book title is Ordinary Joe. The perception is that there's Nice Joe and then there's Joe the hard taskmaster. What do you say to people who say that? Is that part of, for any successful person in sport or in business or whatever, there has to be an edge really to achieve, and you're top of the, you're driving the bus effectively. So what would you say to people who say, well, there's this really pressurized environment that you like to create, is that's in you maybe as a person, and you like to drive people to achieve?
Maybe players would focus on that a little bit, and I explain a couple of the probably initial Monday morning review meetings where
the Dricko one is the famous one.
The Dricko one and as well as that the post Edinburgh game one, you know, where I was pretty cutting, especially after I said, where are you going to be in 5 seconds? And after 3 seconds, I froze the video and I said, wow, you've been doing some great speed work. You haven't moved yet and you're going to be over here in 5 seconds, so you only got 2 seconds to get there, knowing full well they weren't going to get there. But, that is a little bit harsh, and using sarcasm is probably not the ideal thing for a coach. But the ordinary bit is that they're ordinary people too. We had a theme of ordinary men on the back of Christy Moore coming in and singing to the boys, and he sang Ordinary Man, and that became the theme for the week in the build-up to that last game of the Grand Slam in 2018 in Twickenham. And I guess I'm trying to say that ordinary people if they're working hard and they care about people, but they care enough about them that they're going to have a little bit of an edge at times, that extraordinary things can be done, and that's what the players managed to do in that week and at other times, you know, when we had really good days, and thankfully we had a lot more good days than bad. It's just that, as Tuer mentioned, it never finishes well, and unfortunately it didn't, because part of my frustration, Tuer, is it always had finished well for me. With Bay of Plenty, won the Shield and finished right up there, and with the Blues we got to that semi-final, and that was the best we'd done in quite a long time, and as well as that, the Claremont, we won the Buccleuch de Brennus after 100 years of them trying to do it. Even Leinster finished pretty well. We kind of won three trophies that year, even though we didn't get the big European one. We got the secondary one, so it was pretty hard.
So do you have peace of mind now? Since the World Cup, have you been able to find that peace of mind?
Not yet, but I think I will get it later on. And I'm, over the next 3 or 4 months, I'm purposely trying not to think about what I might do next, or because as I said on the late, I haven't earned enough to stay retired indefinitely. I'm going to have to go back to work.
In 2011, Joe, when I retired, I said, right, I'm just going to relax for the next few months. And then I got a call from ITV and a newspaper, yeah. Sky, and so maybe you can come into the media. What do you reckon?
Penguin have done a great job of kind of putting me out there, and that's part of the deal, you know, to try to get a bit of profile around the book to help them. But it's probably not the place that I've ever felt comfortable.
TV analysis for the Six Nations, though. Honestly, like, it's because Roy Keane always swore he'd never do it, and then it turns out he's really good at it.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, and I've enjoyed watching some of what Roy has to say. But, you know, if you talk about edge, I'm not sure my edge is quite as far along the spectrum as Roy's.
Explaining what the opposition are doing, you know, we're getting to a point now where the analysis is finally beginning to tell us stuff, as opposed to when you started and it was all piss and vinegar and bluster. It's definitely improved a lot as your generation of players, that first generation, have come through and started to be able to explain exactly what's happening and why things are happening.
There are definitely some good people involved, and they don't need me involved on top of that. They've got good people.
Well, that brings me to some of the best parts of the book that I really enjoyed the most was you talked about the coaching course that you were on when you were at Claremont, and the research there that showed that ball retention, 60% of the responsibility for the ball retention lies with the ball carrier.
Yeah.
You know, you use the image of the mackerel in the boat. You need to be active, and then the next two guys in are 20% and 20%. And, you know, you tie that to the quote, I think it's Graham Henry talking about the heartbeat of the game is the breakdown. And so this is where we begin to see exactly what your philosophy is and where the bones of how you think about the game come from. Is that fair?
Yeah, and that's what I try to be relatively candid. You know, some people have said I didn't reveal myself in the book. I revealed myself as a coach, I feel, in the book, and a little bit of other things. And certainly, you know, the time that I was walking up the steps for the Blues game, I couldn't get my diaphragm to lift. I felt so much pressure. I was taking really shallow, rapid breaths because I felt so much pressure, just because of expectation and wanting something so much that you have very little control once the ball's kicked off. And so those bits about the big rocks and the, you know, the heartbeat of the game, that's after a number of years of looking at the game. And you mentioned Graham Henry. Well, it's not a bad place to start if you're looking at guys like Ted and what they have achieved in the game. If part of your philosophy kind of overlaps with his,
and also his career path, where there's a perceived brilliant start with Wales and then perceived failure, shocking failure in New Zealand terms in that World Cup, where the New Zealand Rugby Football Union decided to stick with him through that crazy review. Look, I presume you've read all the books around that review. The level of detail that they go into, it could be scarifying to an entire culture to haul everything out into the light and have that. Do we need to do that? Something similar?
You know what? There's so much of what Irish rugby does that's incredibly good. And we don't, it's not our national game like it is in New Zealand. I mean, in New Zealand, there's a transparent expectation from the public. We've built an expectation, and I think that's fantastic, because you want that expectation, because that expectation suggests that you are doing something successful. Because once upon a time, an occasional win against a big team was sufficient. Now there's an expectation we always beat a big team. You know, losing to an All Black team in a quarter final would have been accepted potentially 12 years ago, 10 years ago. Now, losing to the All Blacks is unacceptable. I'm not sure when that shifted, but certainly talking to their staff afterwards, the fact they were massively up for the game was because we'd won two of the last three games against the All Blacks. We didn't often have the opportunity in the past to say that. So, you know, I think to haul everything out, my biggest worry is that they go away from some of the stuff that's been incredibly good. The provinces, they're performing really well in Europe. They always kind of dominate the Pro 14 playoffs. They might not win it. They might. Glasgow popped up, you know, one time. Ospreys popped up one time. Scarlets popped up one time. But in the 10 years I've been here, the rest of the time, it's been dominated by the Irish teams. And so there's a lot of things that are being done well. And on the back of a poor performance against the All Blacks, a poor performance against, certainly in the last 60 minutes, the last 40 minutes particularly in Japan, that we suddenly say, well, we have to completely reconstruct what we're doing. I think those knee-jerk reactions sometimes are a real risk. And that's what New Zealand didn't do in the end, did they? They actually stuck with Graham Henry.
Which was brave at the time, considering there must have been a lot of pressure to get rid of him because that team had failed.
Yeah, you say they failed. Their actual win-loss record was really positive.
Yeah,
and
it's a word, isn't it? Failure.
The way they'd prepared, it's funny because the guy who ran that preparation texted me straight after our game against the All Blacks, and he was an integral part of the players going out of the first six rounds of the Super Rugby competition so that they could get into the best physical condition they could be in. Then they came in, and a number of our guys who came back in didn't actually play well, and then lost a bit of confidence and lost a bit of continuity, and they went into that World Cup in the end a little bit underdone match-wise. So That didn't work, but it was something that they trialled that they thought might work. And
yeah.
And I would say, you know, the thing that I would definitely steer away from next time in the lead up to a World Cup is trying to focus on a World Cup a year out. I think there's too much emphasis on the World Cup already. Our bread and butter is all based around the Six Nations, and I love the Six Nations. I think
after the heights of 2018. Team of the year, coach of the year, world coach of the year, world player of the year. Looking back on it, Joe, is there anything you would have done differently aside from the mental part of maybe looking ahead to maybe looking past the Six Nations and looking too far forward? Because I do agree with you. You know, we're probably best to stay in the process of one game at a time. I always found that as a player, if you take your eye off the ball a little bit, it can skew lots of things. Is there anything you would have done differently from a tactical point of view or a management point of view? Because they seem to lose their mojo, and you kind of said it after the Welsh game that you were broken a bit in the Six Nations. Is there anything you would have done differently looking back? I know that's it's a big question, but that's probably the question people want to know is, you know, did we reach the Everest and then did we kind of tail down a bit, which can happen?
Yeah, see, I think what people don't understand is how fine the margins are. You know, you don't have to be far off for another big team to knock you off. You know, you mentioned that Welsh game. You know, it ended up one try apiece. They scored early, within 2 minutes, and then on the back of a number of penalties, they built a margin in very, very wet conditions, and then you're trying to chase a game, it's very hard to do. You saw the All Blacks lose heavily to the Wallabies and turn it around the following week. I know they did get a red card, but almost, even before that, they were actually struggling a little bit performance-wise.
Because we all thought Ireland were back in the groove with the Scottish game.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I was hopeful of the same. But one of the things about the groove, have a look at the playoffs. you know, how good were the All Blacks against us? And sure, we didn't play well, and some of it was off turnovers where we'd actually created opportunity and then they got the points on the back of it. But then as good as they were against us and as up for the game the following week, how good were England? Then the following week, South Africa stepped up. And, you know, I don't think too many people were picking England to lose that final, because week to week, to get that emotional intensity up, to get that mental focus right, you're dealing with a massive human factor there, and it's hard, I've often been criticised as someone who wants to micromanage everything and control everything. It's almost the opposite if you're in our environment. You'll see how much of the responsibility is shared, particularly with even the senior leaders in the team. But I think part of it is that there are so many things you don't control that you want to have a degree of control over things. We all, it's a human thing to try to control the elements of our life that we can control, because we know that there are all sorts of variables that we can't. So if you don't control the things that are at least influenced by you, then, you know, you already know there's a whole lot of things that aren't.
Yeah, but
you know, decisions or weather or, you know, a little bit of luck, the way the ball bounces on the day.
And being in that position as a head coach, you have a natural leadership volume in yourself as well to want to control. You've got to take some sort of control, but
because you're responsible for
it.
So
sure.
If you don't take control,
your head is on the block, and
exactly,
and that's part of the success. And I don't use the word failure, and the reason I don't use it is because I've been there as a player, and I know that you can put in so much time and effort, and sometimes it just goes wrong, and it went wrong this year. And I personally think, aside from any tactical stuff, or which I'm don't have a strong opinion on, too many of your players just didn't find their consistency throughout the year.
Why do you think that happened, though?
Well, with success, you're in sport, and when you win, the hardest thing to do is when you get up there is stay there for any team and any level. And I think maybe it's a 2% thing, and you can still train well, you can still do all the things, and hindsight's a wonderful thing in sport.
Yeah. I guess that's what the whole point of these conversations are, is to try and find the hindsight to use that to propel what happens next. So take us back to before the England game in the Six Nations then. Now, if you could tap yourself on the shoulder the week before that, what would you be saying to yourself?
That week we focused on the England game. It was the camp before that, and even the
24 hours of Christmas.
And even before that, it was already on our radar. And so if you think back, and people talk about the unbelievable 2018, we weren't overly good in Chicago against Italy, we weren't overly good against Argentina, and we got up for one emotional high against the All Blacks, and I felt we played really well that day, and we deserved to win. So we didn't actually have to do too much in that end, but and prior to that, we'd already started talking about the World Cup. And so then the December camp, so the actual England week itself, but we in the camp week before that, we were already kind of just focused on us and trying to be better ourselves, and doing a lot of recovery.
Having that conversation with the team as well?
With the leadership group. We took the leaders out of that Italian game in Chicago, and we spent, eight guys, we spent 3 days with some external people coming in and talking about leadership and how you best lead. And we were trying to grow our people, because while we were trying to build depth, we were actually trying to build leadership at the same time. That's what we were attempting to do. And so
that all seems like the right thing to do, though.
Yeah, and that's the problem too. You know, you kind of think about it now, and you're trying to build the top end and deepen the base, and that was all that, and it was all going quite well, you know, up until that England game. I felt it was going quite well, and then we didn't play well. Didn't play great against Scotland at all. Johnny went off after 20 minutes, and Joey hadn't had a lot of time either. And then
is the England game in retrospect where it starts to go wrong? Is there collateral damage from that we don't?
Not really. The England game, with less than a quarter of the game left, we're down 17-13 against a team that you saw how they played in the semi-final, and they had everyone there. They had, you know, when they lost later in the Six Nations, there was no Itoje, there was no Mako Vunipola. You know, suddenly it's not quite the same team. It doesn't take too much, and we're very conscious of that ourselves. At the last World Cup, you take out Paul O'Connell, Jared Payne, Johnny Sexton, Pete O'Mahony, Sean O'Brien. Is that the same team that you put out if you haven't got those guys? Now, the guys who came in, that I felt did a good job on the day. But
how many players did you cap since the last World Cup?
I think it'd have to be more than 70. Yeah, 70 or 80. Yeah.
Again, that all seems like exactly the right thing to do. Can we go back to the bit where we're in the World Cup cycle? Because we, as a rugby culture, are a bit trapped in that. And yeah, we're bound to be. Like, yeah, your World Cup diary starts for the World Cup in 2019, but the preparations for Japan 2019 started with individual player reviews a few weeks after our exit from the 2015 Rugby World Cup.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, and it seems like we've all got to this point where this is our white whale, and the white whale ends up killing Captain Ahab.
Yeah, I think the white whale was the All Blacks, though. And we died many deaths. But once we got the white whale, we got the white whale again. And I do think that, you know, those glass ceilings, that the more you focus on the glass ceiling, I think you add layers to it, and then it's harder to break. I think you make it bigger than it really necessarily has to be. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, let's not make it so big, let's not focus so much on it, that it starts to actually
inhibit us.
Become something that it's not.
And that seems to have happened here.
I feel a little bit like that, and I feel that I didn't help, because I helped make it something really, really big for us.
And was that internally with the players and the coaching?
Yeah, and even internally myself, you know, it was something huge for me. And inevitably, you know, I mentioned Daniel Goldman in the book. Your anxiety, your thoughts, your attitude, it does ripple through an environment if you're at the top of the environment. So I do think that I could have managed that better.
How? What would you do now?
I would not talk about it that far in advance. I was always thinking about things in advance anyway. I was always planning in advance. I didn't have to actually, you know, talk about it with the players. And we actually intentionally talked about periodization, about tapering, about recovery and peaking. You know, we'd never talked in those terms before. It was all about, okay, do your recovery for sure, but then let's make sure we get the upswing at the end of the week, not the end of the next year. I mean, that's a long way in the future. And so, yeah, that would be a regret that I have. But, you know, you talk about hindsight, that's, you know, if we'd won that game against the All Blacks, would I feel the same way? I probably wouldn't. And that's always the danger. That's why I say, you know, you look at a review and you say, right, let's make sure we learn from this. I think we can learn things for sure. I think Andy and the team will learn things, and the players will learn things. But I think there's so many good things that have happened over the last 10 years, that my biggest fear is that we suddenly say, okay, we need to do things differently. There are things that we definitely need to fine tune. But I think if we throw the whole thing out, I'd be absolutely disappointed with that, because maybe it's not the best way forward.
What happened in the Japan game?
I think the Japan game, there's been games where I've been on the other side, where a team have scored early and kind of there's an expectation that that's what they should be doing, and that more scores will come. And when we went up 12-3, you know, I think there was an expectation of our players, oh, well, we've just got to keep ticking over here.
Yeah.
And immediately after the kickoff, James Ryan takes an exceptional take of the kickoff, almost leaning horizontally back. We get the ball, cross kick to Keith Earls. Keith Earls gets into good space, gives an inside pass to Rob Kearney. Rob Kearney, we're back over on the attack. We go through a few phases. We get called for a knock-on, which is tough because that momentum then stops when we've got them under pressure. But, Bestie gives the ball back to Tyke Furlong, albeit it bounces up. And, from that scrum, I think we just allow ourselves to taper a bit and the margins are fairly fine. And I think what you saw from Japan is that in front of their home crowd, with any sort of latitude they got given, they made the most of it. And Scotland knew they had to win. It was a one shot. And Scotland are a good team, and they couldn't topple them. And it was, I think, 9-6 at half time against South Africa.
Yeah.
It was very tight. And South Africa went on and won the whole thing.
It was 5-3.
Do you think it was 5-3? Because I did the comms for the Japan game, and I felt comfortable as well at 12-3 because, you probably admit the team didn't have to overextend themselves.
No.
They were doing some good stuff, 12-3 up. That scrum was a massive turning point.
Yeah.
Do you think if you'd beaten Japan and lost the quarterfinal, the reaction would be a bit different? Did that add to the negativity, and maybe would we have a better crack off? Either way,
we said
this in the show many times, either way we were going to South Africa or Japan. If we come out of the group, it's going to be incredibly difficult anyway.
And I mean, South Africa ended up winning the whole thing. And if you look at their game against the All Blacks, when we watched that and analysed it, the All Blacks scored 2 tries in 4 minutes. Apart from that, I think South Africa
were very dominant in
South
the
Africa
early parts.
Actually, the first 20 minutes,
where,
15
they
minutes.
Blew them away.
Yeah. And it wasn't just when they had the ball. It was the All Blacks try to play and get to edges and even try to play through them, but they got absolutely beaten backwards. So, there's no guarantee because of the way South Africa play that they would have been any easier than the All Blacks. We always knew that that quarterfinal was going to be a massive challenge either way. And in the draw, and again, not too many people focused on it, but we got to Fukuoka, and that weekend off was massive for us. And we went out and played. I felt we played well against Samoa, and I know they were a bit bedraggled at that stage, but that weekend off was massive. You had the All Blacks have a weekend off right before playing us. You had England with a weekend off, and Eddie was pretty public about saying, "But that's brilliant. That's great preparation for us. We're off for a tough day's work, and then a few beers, and we'll come back in, and we'll be ready to rock." And and the French, I don't think they were too upset about not getting the chance to top the pool. There were rumours they were going to play a B team because they were already qualified, and then freshen everyone up. And let's face it, I think they're 19-10 up. 30 minutes to go, the 4 or 5 metres driving toward the Welsh line when Vahamahina elbows Wainwright. You'd have to say that at that stage, they are totally in control of that game. They actually missed a few chances in the first half. On the basis of how that game was being played at the time, that those three teams all looked to be in great frame of mind, great physical condition, and I think it was a bit of an advantage that again, that's what I'm talking about, uncontrollables. We can't control that. You just got to get on, and I felt we could still be really competitive, and unfortunately we weren't.
Are you going back and second guessing your team selections at any point? Could Sexton have played against Japan, for example, or was he not fit?
Yeah, see, the problem was that we felt that he may then injure himself. It was tenuous.
Right.
And, if we played him against Japan and he'd done damage and he hadn't been able to play against Russia and Samoa, or potentially, if he was out for 3 weeks, then that's why I say... in hindsight, would you do it differently? I'm not sure that I'd do that differently. Jack Carty had impressed us, and he started the game the first 20 minutes. I thought he was really good.
Yeah.
And the way we wanted to play that game actually suited the way Jack played. And the fact that, the 2 tries came from the kicks, the short kicking game for the second try, the wide kicking game for the... And then the line break immediately after, it looked like it looked like the decision was vindicated at that stage. And could we have predicted that the way that things would turn? I don't think you could blame all that on Jack, because we got hesitant defensively.
It was more the leadership issue, I kind of feel, as opposed to the skill set.
That might be right. I think with Jack, he is a bit quieter. He hadn't had, you know, Johnny is
is a very
important cog for us in that leadership, and in that position, it's hard to get away from a leadership responsibility, because you're calling the shots and you're the conduit for a lot of the play that we try to create.
One of the other criticisms that has been levelled is that you were very loyal to the players who got you there, and it's understandable enough that, you know, this is the group of players who got us to being the best team in the world. We beat the All Blacks twice. Do you feel that now? Do you agree with that? Is that unfair?
Yeah, I'm not sure that, you know, because one of the players that had got us there, we didn't take and became a big story. And for me, it's probably one of the hardest discussions I've had. So I'm not sure that the criticism is completely valid. But there were some guys there, you know, that we felt the All Blacks were going to do some things early in the game, and they did exactly what we expected. What'd they do with the first ball they got? They hoiked it in the air as high as they could, straight into our 22, because they wanted to make it an aerial contest to start with, because they, without getting into double jeopardy, they felt we would try to come hard off the line at them. They didn't want to get knocked behind the line like they did with South Africa early in the game. So put it in behind us so they can go after us. So we felt that we would best solve that by having experience at the back. I think you have a rationale for doing things, and then you have hindsight again that can always question a rationale. And I think one of the things that frustrates me personally is that I have that same hindsight, and I second guess myself. I say in the book, whether we win, lose or draw, I question what we do. I look back and I say, maybe this or maybe we could have done that. But
the rationale gives you peace of mind, though, because if I was going back without the hindsight, I'd make the same decision, because the decision was based on logic and it wasn't based just on loyalty to these players.
No, I felt there was logic in it. And the other thing is that, you've never been in a selection meeting. The selection meetings, as I shared about, the perception of wanting to control and micromanage, I'd love to bring some of these people into our environment and allow them to sit there. Now, I wouldn't, because
unfair perception then. If you're saying that that is the case, Joe is not this control freak that people sometimes make. Is that, like, because that's sometimes, whether it's right or wrong, that's the perception, that Joe controls everything. But you're saying that from the other selectors, if they spoke and they'd say something totally different. Yeah. I mean that respectfully.
And that's
now
why, that's why, you know, selection meetings will sometimes be two and a half hours. And I don't know as much about certain positions as some of the other people in our, you know, if you've got really good people, and I had super people.
Give us an example of a forward selection.
Well,
then, is there?
I don't know. I don't know what, a lucid prop. I don't know the ins and outs of the scrummaging that they have to do and the line out responsibility they have. I'm going to be part of the discussion for sure. But
you trust Greg Feeks?
Hugely.
Call on that.
I worked with Feeky for 10 years.
So the props now know that Greg actually dropped him, not Joe.
and that is far from the truth, because And whether it gives an impression that you're a control freak or not, I know that it's my responsibility. And when we come out of any selection meeting, we are all in agreement. And so everyone contributes, but then I know my head is on the block, as you described. Therefore, I stand over any of the selections we make. And That's your job as a head coach.
Responsibility of the head coach.
Well, it is.
If you ever
abdicate that, I think it's...
But that brings pressure as well, doesn't it? Because you have to take the accountability. I often said it about head coaches, that some assistant coaches that I would have worked with in Munster and Ireland over the years became head coaches, and their personality and the pressure kind of gets to them.
Yeah.
And it can do, and it's a hard thing to manage, because you have a lot of... you have to take everything on board, don't you?
And I think I say in there that, you know, there can be real distractions. And you have people questioning, I mentioned in there, you're questioning the decisions you make, but even then, some of them even question your personality or your character, and it can be quite personal. And so, you know, it's really important. I think one of the things for coaches is to have people that they trust, that give them genuine feedback. And if it's criticism, it's criticism. You know, there's people that I would turn to chat to that, you know, if they said, look, to be honest, you know, why did you do that? Or why did you pick him? Or, you know, and I would think back and, but there are sometimes you see people who are outside the environment who've kind of never played the game at a high level. And
can I ask why you care about them so much?
Because they influence the players.
Do they though?
Yeah, they do. Because things leak in. Because they have a platform, Drew. You know, because they have that platform, because it's so visible, other people absorb it. And inevitably, it's like the team leaking out. Once you name the team, you know it's probably going to get out. Because they're, especially, imagine you're picked for the first time, Drew Gilroy, to play, I'm not sure which position.
I think you know, but go on.
You're going to tell your mum and dad,
Yeah. You're
going to tell your siblings, even your best mate, and it does tend to leak out like that. It drifts in like that as well. Where, you know, someone will say, oh, you know, there's doubt about this and people are questioning this. And you know, to the extent that, you know, when players are just trying to get their confidence and things like that, it can be quite tough, you know. And I know people feel that, you know, that play, that the top of the, that's still very human.
They're ultimately very fragile. It felt sometimes like they cared a little bit too much about that stuff. Now, I bumped into a couple of them in Japan on the Sunday night after the game, and they were upset with the media and they were talking about it. And I felt like, yeah. I felt even Johnny addressed it on the Friday in the press conference before the last game. He was like, look, I'm sitting here. If we lose this game, a lot of you are going to be saying I'm washed up. And I'm like, just, you all need to stop thinking about that. I felt it was like,
but I get it, Joe, in a sense that because I was on both sides of the fence. I'm now the dreaded media, if you like, but being the player, and it does get in no matter how much you block it out. The one thing that would irritate me, and I can empathize with you, is if there's inaccuracies. I never had a problem with if someone had a cut off you for playing crap. Yeah. But sometimes it's the inaccuracies, and it's probably the experience of blocking it out comes with experience, doesn't it?
Yeah. And
younger player.
There are some of our players who you know, would get upset with a sense of injustice if somebody has focused on one thing they did in the game and they felt they did a lot of other things well, and, you know, and they got labelled with, you know, their whole game was centred around, you know, I thought JJ played.
I was going to say,
played great in the weekend.
Example, played really well. Misses a drop goal. Yeah.
And then he misses a drop goal at the end, and suddenly, the whole thing is coloured by that. And a player, you know, who's played really well, and I think he played really well, and he kicked the conversion from the sideline to put them level anyway. Yeah. But then I look at some of the things that get said, and I can understand his frustration. I think it's easy for you to say, why did they let it? Because they're human.
Well,
because they feel that it's unjust.
So it's not that easy. You should check our YouTube comments sometime. They're not very good. A lot of people don't like what we do. So we're exposed to it every day. And you just have to develop a thick skin. Because there was a bit where Sloaney tells you, great advice he gave me, don't read the papers and don't listen to the radio. And yet, like, you find yourself listening to the radio.
Well, one of the things that is difficult for me, the players don't always have to do media. But I do. So what is being said is going to be the starting point of a media interview. So if I'm not aware of what's being said, then
the question might blindside you.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a risk in that. Now, since the World Cup final, I haven't had to, or the quarterfinal, I haven't really, since the World Cup final, since I've been in the public eye, because I certainly wasn't for 2 weeks because I was keeping my head down. But I'm not nearly as across what's been said as I would have been if I'd been going into a media conference at the December camp or before the Six Nations and being asked about these things, because I'd be across what the themes were, Mourinho, so that I could respond.
Would you take any criticisms as a positive? I know there's a fine line between someone saying stuff out of context and someone actually saying something that's true. Would you actually ever go, you know, there's some truth to maybe us not playing well on a
especially,
Saturday?
Especially some people, you know, who you think, yeah, he's dead right. You know, I can't hide from the fact that he's dead right. We didn't do this well enough, and we've got to take that on the chin. And I think all coaches, even around
your own performance, because you know I had that before when I criticised Munster, and you know you're in a place where you're.
Yeah,
why I've gone here, but sometimes
I think you are emotionally attached, though.
Yeah,
and
would you being emotionally attached, and does that affect your judgment sometimes?
I think it does, because I am emotionally attached, because you can't put so much into something, and I know people have perceptions around me, and I say that I don't take a day off because there's always something pops into your head or you're consciously working, but even unconsciously you think about, geez, maybe we could try this or maybe we could do, and it, you know, that sort of thing. If you put that much effort into something, then
you're going to fight for us.
Of course you are.
But people, on that one, I just want to say this one, Jerry, let you ask Joe then. You know the day off thing that you said, you know what the perception there is, and that that's way too much that Joe never took. I understand what you mean.
Yeah.
You're not working 12 hours a day, every day, 7 days a week.
No,
it just means that your mind is switched on. Because I had it as a player. You might have Thursday or Friday off, but you're not off. You're off from resting the body, but mentally you could be on the video, you could be doing stuff.
I would have encouraged players to take a block off, like a whole day, or you know, get their work done early in the week, take a whole day. Just to encourage them. You know, there's one time in there where Paul said to me, you know, text the players and say, do something.
Yeah.
Don't think about it, you know. And I even consciously tried to do it myself. And I remember I watched the movie with my two youngest kids that day because I felt I needed to freshen up, you know.
It's very difficult, though, isn't it, to separate and get out of it when you're
because you're so embedded in it.
There was one last thing on that, because when you say you respect if the viewpoint is coming from somebody you respect, so obviously we work a lot with Brian, and himself and Issa both talked about the failure at the World Cup. What did you make of what Issa had said?
Yeah, it's funny because I haven't seen the podcast and I haven't read what he said, but
you heard about it.
He texted me and said, "Hey Joe, the way I phrased things, it didn't quite come out as I meant it to." I could show you the text. You know, a lot of it was very, very positive. About what I'd done in Leinster and how he felt I'd influenced Irish rugby. And so I'm not sure what he did say, but or what Dricko said. It's like Dricko.
I have some of the stuff that he said. Yep. Just for clarity, in case I don't want you to think that we hadn't given you the chance to see it. Joe started to go away from his tried and trusted drills and introduced a bit of what we call unstructured play that came into Ireland camp and training. And in the Six Nations, they were throwing offloads. There was continuity to their play. That got them all the way to the top of the world and an unbeaten year with all the trophies. Is that your post-event narrative that you talk about coming in, where the team plays well and wins games and everybody...
Yeah, it's interesting because in Leinster, in Ireland, we would have always done unstructured play. You know, we had a drill that we would do, you know, in every open session, you know, with three sausage bags, and you know, I'd intentionally try to unstructure it, and we'd kick balls in behind them. We'd do all sorts of unstructured play. So, I guess sometimes Issa's looking for, because we all do it. I'm not sure I've got it right. Maybe it is the right thing to plan something a year out. I just, in retrospect, I don't think that's the right thing.
Maybe plan it, but don't tell everybody you're planning it.
Well, yeah, I think that's probably valid too, Jure. But you know, I'd be pretty close with Issa.
For years.
And even during the World Cup, you know, text conversations were happening. So, you know, I'm not sure that, because even players who are there, they start trying to find reasons. But when you're forcing yourself to find reasons, you might come up with something that's not actually much of a contributor to the outcome, because we look for this cause effect relationship, but when there are so many variables, it's very difficult to say, oh, that's a cause effect, you know. And
because sport is made up of a million different things. In the last 48 hours, you've been linked with Ian Foster's management team in New Zealand. And don't
really?
Have you seen this? Have you not seen this?
Oh,
yeah,
sure.
So you and Greg Feek and the forwards coach who you had for a year, John
Plumtree.
Yeah, apparently the three of you are all going to be part of his backroom team.
Fozzie's
you're
going to
be number two, so it's like obviously clearly a sign exactly
he's
what
he's put you in as one of his part of his team.
Maybe he's the agent.
No, Fozzie knows, and I know that I'm not part of that team, and I've had discussions with him for a long time, but well before the World Cup. But you know, I think. I'm not sure I'll ever go back into coaching. I'm not sure what I'm going to do. And what I'm intentionally trying to do at the moment is just not even think about it for 4 or 5 months. And we're not going to do anything until Luke finishes his school year. So that's, you know, end of May, early June. And then we'll definitely try to spend a bit of the summer here before we decide where we go next, and whether that's staying here or whether it's going to France or whether it's going back to New Zealand.
Because I know that there's lots of business people who you've got connections with who I have no doubt you could work with in a range of different ways. But it does seem to me that you've built up a lot of rugby IP, that you've reached a situation in your career now where you've had a big setback compared to the level of success you've had everywhere else. And that's the bit where the great coaches learn so much about themselves, even the self-analysis you're already doing.
Yeah.
Belichick failed at the Cleveland Browns before he became the greatest sports coach in any sport of all time. Like, Graham Henry failed. I know you don't use that word, but like, then went on to release the burden on somebody. It would be a shame to waste all the stuff, especially the self-reflection.
Yeah, and part of it, I remember getting off the plane, and we'd had to get up at 3:30 to get to the airport, and the plane journey, there's a bit of angst about, I knew I had to meet the media at the airport, and you're at a bit of a low ebb, plus you're really tired. And I remember saying there that I was kind of motivated to go back into coaching because I didn't want it to end like that. And there's still because it's still raw, because the scab hasn't formed over the wound, I still feel a little bit like that. And that's why I'm trying to give myself the distance and say 4 or 5 months' time, if I still feel like that, then maybe I'll go back into rugby coaching, because I agree with you. I've learnt through the last 25 years, but I've learnt a lot in the last 2 months.
What would make you not go back into coaching?
Just, I guess, I can't help but go in fully. You know, I got offered one job, you know, they said to me, "Oh, look," I said, "No, look, I'm not ready to go back into full time." And they said, "Look, what about we just set the job up and it's only 3 days a week?" And I just looked at the guy, and the guy knows me, and it's a job not here. But I said to him, I can't do 3 days a week. If something needs to get done, I think I can find a margin here or whatever, I'm going to commit fully. So I can't agree to a three-day work week in coaching, because it's too hard not to think, wow, yeah, I can go and see this guy.
Would you not dip in and out as a consultant if a certain team would want you for periods of time? Some Graham Henry came to Leinster for a little bit of time and some things like that.
That sort of thing, maybe. Because the only thing is, I love the actual coaching on the pitch. When you're a consultant, you're watching someone coach and giving them feedback. The bit that I love about the job is kind of working out a strategy, trying to help a player to get better. And that's one of the frustrations of doing a national team is that, you know, if Jura is playing at 10 for us and he whips in for 6 weeks, and then he's gone again, and then he whips in for a Southern Hemisphere tour for 2 or 3 weeks. You know, I don't actually work in a progression with that player. I just help them get organised in a very short window, and it's not individual coaching. It's just coordinating a team.
Did that change the way you coach Leinster then to Ireland?
Not really, because part of the continuity, and I know I copped criticism initially for having a lot of Leinster players in the Irish team, but it's part of that continuity was that we did the same things. You know, there was very little difference from what Leinster were doing to what Ireland were doing, because we had the big rocks were exactly the same rocks, you know, and it's just that sometimes, I think, let's take Scotland for an example in the World Cup. Against us, they were stifled. They didn't have the chance to play. They actually, and I say in the book, that the possession territory was pretty 50-50. In fact, they had more of it, because in the second half, they attacked a fair bit. But they didn't get any score. Then their next two games against Samoa and Russia, gee, they looked $1 million. There was offloads, and then they suddenly came up against Japan, and they scored that early try, and then there was probably, you know, a 30-minute period where they were really struggling to get anything together. Because the problem with going from a provincial team or a club team into the test arena is everything has less time and space about it. And you know, I think you may have a willingness to play a certain way. And we also, two of the guys who offloaded the most for Leinster were Dricko and Sean O'Brien. They were two of the guys who offloaded the most. Well, Dricko then retired a year afterwards. The 2014 was his last, and then Shawnee, he had a very
disrupted
period
with the injuries.
And so as much as we tried to get him in, and he could create play. Now, a lot of it was because Dricko was not a big man, but he had the ability to control the collision. He had that late footwork and super silky skills, you know, inside out, you know. And Shawnee had a bit of both, not quite the real footwork, but it was pretty good. But he was this tank, and so he still freed the ball up. And so sometimes the sort of player helps it happen as well. Because as soon as you get a player who's not really used to doing it, or he's not overly good at it, as soon as he thinks about doing that before he's won the collision, I think then you lose a collision. You saw New Zealand versus England. They split them open a few times, and I thought, wow, you know.
Have you ever told a player not to offload in a match?
We were in Paris playing Russing one day when they were Russing Metro, and there was doubt whether the game would go ahead. The pitch was frozen earlier in the day. We actually travelled down to the pitch and had a look, and it was frozen during the day. Anyway, they decided to play the game, and bits of it were still like this. And we started the game offloading, we were throwing ball away. And I sent a message on. I just said, look,
hold on to the ball.
Put away the offload for the next 10 minutes. No offloads for the next 10 minutes. I want them to have to work harder to get the ball back, because I felt that we were always a bit fitter than the French teams. And as soon as we forced them to make 10 phases of tackles, we got space anyway, because they started to be a bit slower to get in the position. And so that's one that comes to mind. But
I've been on teams that we've had to call in the group and say, stop offloading the ball, we're turning it over, wet conditions and stuff.
Yeah.
But again, it's that sometimes the perception, we call it, that Joe doesn't want fellas to offload, and, you know.
Yeah. I mean,
it's probably.
You have a look at. I mean, there was a perception that's what I was coaching in Leinster, because it was happening so often. It was happening because we were winning collisions and we had players who were very adept at doing it. I got asked after the Japan game, where we made more offloads than we normally would. Is that a change, and is that not working for us? And the change hadn't been made at all. It was just that...
Yeah. The circumstances.
The circumstances, and then we tried to chase the game a bit when we were 7 points down, and it's just the way it evolved. Because people think that you've got an influence on the game. Again, once the players get out there, you could send a message on, but really, there's a fair bit of distance between you and what's happening on the pitch.
Yeah. Look, that was fascinating, because I think that is definitely one of the topics that we don't get to tease out too often with the Ireland coach, in this instance, the former Ireland coach.
Former.
And he may be again.
Retired or Irish coach.
The book is called Ordinary Joe. It's by Joe Schmidt. It's available now and published by Penguin Ireland. He's going to be in conversation with Joe Malloy in Dublin, Limerick and Belfast. Tickets for the events are available at penguin.co.uk/events. Best of luck with it and enjoy the next couple of months anyway.
Yeah, thanks to you.
Thanks,
Ian. Cheers. Thanks.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.